Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Of course.
I did not want them dead.
You did too.
I did not.
Did too.
I did not.
Did too.
I did not.
Did too.
Did not.
Did too.
Did not. Did not. Did not. Shut up. I did not want them to.
Oh, come on, you
Mary
did.
Had
you just
a little
not.
Lamb, little lamb, but little lamb.
I know
lamb.
What you.
But I wanted a little lamb.
Yes.
I did not.
Young love. Did you hear? School's canceled today because Kurt and Ram killed themselves in a repressed homosexual suicide pact.
No way.
God!
Football season is over, Veronica. Kurt and Ram had nothing to offer the school but date rapes and AIDS jokes.
Sure. Could we make an ice run before the funeral?
If there's any way you can hear me, Kurt, buddy. I don't care that you really were some pansy. You're my own flesh and blood, and no, you made me proud. My son's a homosexual, and I love him. I love my dead gay son.
It is 35 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of January in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for family values and amusements. Thank you for drawing near to our emporium of giggles. It is 503-505-6964. You should get with the talking and the dialing and the calling and the hey-hey and the wah-wah and the mahoygan. It's 503-505-6964 with your comments, questions, clarifications, etc., so on and so forth. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It is rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. If you want to message us via Skype, you can do that as well. The Skype. Wait. Ooh. Let me make sure that it's actually on and operating correctly. Wait. Yeah, there we go. If you want to message us, it is Skype. Rick Emerson Show, rather, is our Skype username. It is Rick Emerson Show, the username for Skype. You can email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached. Can't you, Don?
I can indeed. You can reach me. Reach me.
It's Don at rickemerson.com. It is Don at rickemerson.com. Text box open on the website and all that. About what would you speak? About what, dear Liza? About what? About what? The following things, you know, or perhaps something else, that's entirely different. Got your corpse watch coming up today. I still can't believe we have a Jackson watch. Here's the thing. I have no idea what it could possibly be about, and it's like, and I don't want to know. I want it to be a total surprise.
Okay.
So rarely are things with Michael Jackson surprised at this point, because really, what could he do at this point that would surprise me? And I think by definition, the answer is nothing.
Well, not a lot, really.
Get up and dance around some
that
more, I suppose.
That would be surprising.
I guess. You know, sort of a...
Like if the children put a magical top hat on him, and then he just sort of, happy birthday! And then just, you know, that's unlikely to happen, though.
I will say that the actual watch itself, the things that will be revealed, probably will not shock or surprise you, but... Again, you know, we have to stay on top of the Jackson news.
Well, you know, it's like, look, and here's the thing. any Jackson news is good news.
Yeah.
Because it's an excuse to do the Jackson Watch, which we have not had in quite some time. So, Corpse Watch coming up today. Snuff Watch coming up today. Again, your Jackson Watch coming up today. Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. He will be in the studio later on today. Be talking about a whole fistful of things. A, the new issue of Willamette, which is coming out. And I think, well, I shouldn't say the other thing, because the other thing may not be... It either may not be, like, public, it may not be a thing that he has announced, or it just is something that may have changed, plans may have altered. But
is he having a baby?
Yes. No. hey, let me ask you this.
Did he change his mustache again?
What is the deal with the... What is it with that Paul Anka song, You're Having My Baby? Why did that need to exist?
It's creepy.
It's completely creepy, but I mean, what is the... You know, that ought to be like a pop culture authority, but it's just like, what the hell would be the question there? What in the name of Christ? Like, I want to know, first of all, did Paul Anka himself write that, do you think? Was that a thing that he created, or was that just like... Or was that the ghostly, liver-spotted hand of some A&R guy going, You know what people like? People love songs about babies. So how about it's like, you're having a baby... But I mean, not you, because you're a man, and so you. But collectively, as a couple, a baby's going to be had by you, and you're excited, and so you're telling her how excited you are about, having the baby. There you go. You're having my baby. Ba 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 ba, and then like a little guitar solo, and then maybe some clapping at the end, and you're good. It's a gold single, and then he's went and recorded it, and it's just the creepiest song ever.
Well, you know, he did write a lot of songs, but wasn't he kind of getting on in years at the time he released that? Wasn't he already like 60 or something?
It doesn't mean he can't reproduce.
Yeah,
Tony Randall probably having kids right now. I mean, is Tony Randall dead?
Yes.
Are you sure?
I am sure.
You're absolutely...
I am absolutely sure Randall is dead.
Forgive the phrase. You are dead certain.
I am dead certain that Tony Randall is indeed deceased.
Okay. Well,
he's no longer with us.
But, you know, he was having kids up to being like, you know, he was like 85, 88 years of age, and he was like, well, I just can't wait to have more children. And he would just, you know, him and his like weird pink satin smoking jacket.
Yeah.
Who were the women who were being impregnated by Tony Randall?
Well,
I'm assuming they look like his mother.
Well, the woman that had married him and had a child with him not long before his death was like half his age and was basically his assistant.
Do you suppose those were natural conceptions? Are you looking up Tony Randall facts?
No.
Are you looking up Paul Anka facts?
I'm looking up
Paul
Anka facts.
You've got to. Here's the thing.
I wanted to find out if you wrote, "You're having my baby."
Here's the thing that's going to drive you insane if you don't get it under control. It is your desire to wiki every conceivable hyperlink in the paragraph of the opening monologue. Because that way lies madness. That's like trying to identify all of the samples on introducing. It can never be done, and you will just end up. You'll end up gibbering in a room with Inspector Dreyfus.
But I want to know things, right?
But you know, the thing is, you've got people for that. You've got an app for that. The app is the audience.
Okay. Well, email me if you know facts about Paul Anka and whether or not he wrote.
So you're looking into whether he wrote "You're Having My Baby" because he performed it. But the question,
right.
And here's it is complicated by this. It's complicated by the fact that I sometimes confuse him for reasons that I can't really explain or quantify. I confuse him with Burt Bacharach. And I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
I want to open a store that sells nothing but Bacharach bric-a-brac. Yeah. That was a little, you know, that was, I just came up with that right now.
I saw him in traffic once when I was living
Burt
in Los
Bacharach?
Angeles. Yes, I was on my way to get my haircut in Santa Monica, and I was on what they call Little Santa Monica Boulevard, because there's a bigger Santa Monica Boulevard that runs parallel to it. So there's what they call Little Santa Monica. And I was on Little Santa Monica Boulevard, and I was stopped in traffic, and there was this guy in this convertible next to me, this like cream-colored, like Bentley convertible or something, stopped next to me. And I looked over, and I thought, as you do when you see people, because I do that thing that I think you do the same. You see people and you think, that guy looks like a cross between Stephen King and Richard Belzer.
Right.
You know, and I looked at this guy and went, wow, that guy looks just like Burt Bacharach. And then I thought for a moment, I thought, well, it might be Burt Bacharach.
Because you're there in L.A.,
yeah.
So yeah.
So I turned and I gave him a really good hard look and I thought, holy crap, that actually is Burt Bacharach. And of course, you know, at that point, the light changed and that was our entire interaction. But
that's a great story, Don.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. It is the sort of thing that doesn't happen in most other cities, though, which is why people in L.A., whether because they really feel this way or because they feel they have to be cool, they have the sort of nonplussed thing going on. You know, like you're in a restaurant and it's like, who's that? Well, it's Debbie Harry. I'm not going to look at her or ever say that I like her music. I'm going to look at the floor when I walk by.
Well, now that I live in Portland, when I see someone and they look familiar, I assume I first wonder, do I know them from somewhere? Did I go to culinary school with them? Do I know them through radio? Do I know them? Wherever. And I try to figure out where I know them. And I've also come to realize that Portland is a much smaller town than I come from. So sometimes people look familiar just because they always seem to be at the same movies and go to Powell's, such as you.
You see them at the Plaid Pantry all the time.
And then every once in a while, I'll do that thing where I'm going, oh, well, it must be someone I know. And then I'll realize it really is someone on TV. You know, and it's like Andy Carson or somebody. I'll go, oh, okay, he looks familiar because he actually is someone, you know,
and
on TV.
And then you do the thing I do of just then pretending that you could not possibly care less about this thing that your brain actually just spent time thinking about and working on.
Right.
Yeah. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964. Here's what's coming up today. We have Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch, Jackson Watch, Aaron Mesh will be here. Top five. So it's the anniversary. When you say the anniversary of Prohibition or the Volstead Act, is it of the passage of Prohibition? The institution of Prohibition?
Yes.
How many years ago was it today?
Yes. I was going to have this up so that I could tell you the exact year, and then I ended up
those
closing.
Precious moments frittered away on Paul Anka knowledge.
I got distracted by the shininess of Paul Anka.
Well, everybody does.
Prohibition took effect January. Wait a minute, that's not right. That's this week in history. God damn it. Anyway.
Well, now you can't do it. You brought shame on your whole family, Don.
I could hold my top five.
No, we'll do it. All right. You know, like we ever do anything. I can count on one finger, you know, the number of times we've ever done anything on its actual anniversary.
Well, this week in 1919, Prohibition took effect.
So that would have been 90, God, I'm dumb, 92 years ago?
Yes.
All right. So 93 years ago, Prohibition. What a weird, I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but that's just bizarre. You know, that would, the idea that we ever just thought that we could keep people from boozing in this country is just, I mean, I know that we've said, people say that after the drug war, you know, but it's like, but it's different in the sense that drugs have always been, you know, even when they were legal, been a little bit taboo. Drinking was just like everywhere. And it was like, it was a legal, you know, thing. You could just, you know, you just buy it anywhere and you could, you know, you send your children to the store to buy you, you know, a huge crate of whiskey and to bring it on home. I mean, it penetrated the society in a way that drugs did not even before they were prohibited, even before they became illegal. The idea that in any way they thought that, you know what that is? That was just the, like the Prohibition chicks. They just did some sort of like, you know, some like Aspasia thing where they just refused to put out until their husbands got rid of the hooch.
Well, all rules, all the laws about alcohol are really bizarre anyway. Like in the United States, you have some like we still have dry counties where you can't buy liquor.
Monmouth.
Yeah. Here in Oregon, we have like weird laws coming from California again. The law was you couldn't sell alcohol, you couldn't sell liquor between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. So there was like this four-hour window.
Right.
What is that solving? And then I move here, and you can't buy booze, like, anywhere, basically. It's like I came here and I went to the supermarket and was going to buy some rum, and there was no rum at the supermarket, and I didn't understand why. And then somebody had to explain to me, oh, no, we have these state-operated liquor stores that are only open from, like, 11 a.m. to, like, 7 o'clock at night. And you're like, what?
Well, in California, you can just go. I mean, there's just, like, drive-thrus where they'll just give you a gun, you know, and a bong and a bottle of, you know, and a bottle of Captain Morgan and be on your way now.
In California, you go to, like, the equivalent of Rite Aid or Walgreens, and they have liquor departments.
Yeah. You know, what's like living in Utah now where, you know, here's the thing they've done in Utah, and this doesn't affect me because it's not like I'm going to go there and get all loaded. First of all, and then we have to get back on point, but I will say this about the top five, which is based on the Prohibition Act, which took effect 92 years ago this week. So we're going to be doing the top five songs about drinking. And by the way, bully for you, ma'am, for even attempting to do that. I know that you got rid of country songs, which makes it easier, but still, Jesus, you got to figure like 80% of songs in rock are about either sex or substance abuse or sex while you are abusing a substance.
Well, I basically decided the way to narrow it down was I eliminated country songs, then I eliminated any songs that just mentioned alcohol as a metaphor or in passing.
The song had to be the central focus of the song. The subject of the song had to be booze in some way.
Right. The song is basically about drinking. And then you just basically narrow it down to songs I actually like. that I would listen to.
This is the difference between you and is that you feel no need to be objective about these things. You feel no need to distance yourself. You view everything, and this is fine. It's not there's any right or wrong way to do it. You view everything just unashamedly through the prism of what Dawn thinks is good or crap. Whereas me, like, I feel this sort of like weird. I feel this weird like a Hornbian sensibility of like I must speak for all mankind on this top five.
I feel that way sometimes, particularly if it's a narrower kind of a thing where, you know, I don't have as many choices. Then it's kind of like it seems obvious that X needs to be on the list because it is one of the greatest songs about this particular subject. But in something this broad, it really does become very subjective.
I won't say what it is, but I'm just thinking of one, and I know everybody does this, but I'm thinking of one that I just, it can't, I'm thinking of one that it seems like it can't, and I haven't looked. You printed it out, and I handed it to you, but I tried not to look at the list. I'm thinking of one that it seems it has to be on there.
And it might not.
See, and if it's not, it just calls into question everything I thought I knew about you and the universe and the few fragile years that we spend upon this ball of dirt whirling its way through the cosmos.
Well, then maybe you'll have to do your top five songs about losing.
I'm not going to get ahead of myself. I'll wait. I'll reserve judgment. So Corpse Watch today, Snuff Watch, Jackson Watch, Aaron Mesh from Alamed Week. Also get the top five songs about drinking. Today's show brought to you in part by EH Vending. Find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. So if you operate a business, if you have some sort of a company, you have, you know, whether it's one store, whether it's five stores, whether it's one outlet, if you got a garage, you got, you know, some sort of a salon, an emporium, a seller of wares, a seller of necks or nicks, and you want to have a vending machine there, or maybe you got a vending company and you just feel like they're jerking you around, or you're paying too much, or they don't want to deal with you because you're a small enough company, you only got one or two outlets, and you know you just feel like you're getting a raw deal. You can contact EH Vending and they will find something that works for you. And it's not just vending machines; it's also coffee service. It's the little sandwichy doodads. I found that they do have those, by the way, where it's like a little window and you open it up, and then there's like the egg salad with the one piece of like that iceberg lettuce that just seems to have come from a different era altogether, sitting in there.
I wonder how much it costs to actually rent one of those, because it would be kind of cool to get one of those
for a week
and put really interesting things in there,
like a baby.
Yeah, like
or
a baby,
or just like a bunch of like a bag of fingernails.
Yeah, or a, you know, a bucket of eels.
Yeah. See, that would be weird. How much would you charge for... When you say a bucket of eels, you can't really fit a bucket in there.
No.
What you'd have to do is you'd have to put, like, a cup of eels, which is like a cup of noodles, but more wiggly.
Like one of those little plastic one-pint takeout containers.
I'm thinking, like, but a thing of, like, really, you get the Maruchan, you know, the cup of noodles thing with, the, like, a pull bag and a styrofoam. Cup of eels. What would you... I'm saying right now, if you were to sell that in a machine, what is it you would charge for such an item?
No.
Dead eels or alive?
Well, that's the difference. Live eels would probably cost more.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
I'd go $6-7 for live eels, but I probably wouldn't go over $3 for dead eels.
See, on the other hand, though, it could be like a Papa Murphy's thing, where the live eels are cheaper because then you got to go home and you got to bludgeon them yourself, or whack them with some, or electrocute them, whatever it is you do.
Yeah.
How does one prepare eels?
But they're fresher if they're still swimming.
Yeah, but well, okay. This is a stupid cut. This is even by our standards, this is a waste of our time. Right, I just realized that was we are getting closer to death with every heartbeat. However long we have on Earth, we're like 30 seconds closer to the end of it right now, because we were talking about selling a bucket of eels out of a machine.
We keep saying that there's no way we'll ever run out of things to talk about, and then we have conversations like that, and you think, you know, it is possible we might run out of things to talk about.
See, but that conversation, I look at it exactly the other way, though. That is, to me, is you're seeing two ladies kissing, I'm seeing a white candlestick. Because that's proved to me that we will never run out of things that have not been discussed before. Because that's never been discussed before by anyone ever. No one has ever had the conversation. I'd have a bucket of eels and a vending machine, and I'll sell it. And then the whole, like, live dead Papa Murphy's.
Well, not in a non-Asian country.
That's true. All right, well, chunk. And this is all true. It's 503-505-6964. So that is all on the way. Also, we may or may not get to this. I don't know. My sources point to no. I didn't even tease this last hour because it sounds like the show is already... We already got so much going on.
Yeah.
And then you got Ham-Fisted Radio coming up this afternoon at Cascadia.fm, 4 p.m. Pacific time. You and Bobby Roberts.
I do.
Talking
I do
about, I would imagine, nothing in particular.
Not a clue. But and yet we, again, like the bucket of eels, we always find something to talk about.
So that is that's a smattering of the things. If we need more... Right here in my hands, I have prepared another installment of the greatest songs ever made.
Ooh.
Probably won't need it, though. That's the thing. I'm telling you right now. Don't get your hopes up. Probably end up doing it. That'll be tomorrow. And so forth. I don't even really know what I was going to talk about here in this opening segment. Because you do the whole... You could, and here's why. Because you do the whole... You know, we do the whole setup, and then we talk about headlines such as the following, which you were tracking on this Wednesday.
That a creepy neighbor is accused of licking a child's ear. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is recovering nicely from her shooting. And a man is arrested for missing... He is arrested and misses his own wedding.
So we've got those things to get to. And then I know that there were a couple of things last hour that I made you swear to Christ Almighty you would not let us forget. Because they were going to be areas of discussion.
Right. We've got the TriMet driver who is running over people. And you wanted to talk about that more.
And there was some sort of a graph or a chart or something I wanted to make.
I had something.
Failed me, haven't you?
No, I scribbled it down on one of my many pieces of paper, and it's here somewhere.
Here's the thing. I anticipated you losing it, so I wrote it down myself.
We were going to talk to Aaron Mesh about, we wanted to see if we could track everything in history that's ever been blamed for corrupting youth or causing violence in people.
Well, in recent history, because otherwise then you're back at Socrates, and it's a whole thing.
You're not the only one with pieces of paper, mister.
Is that going to be your new thing? Is this because it sounds like thunder in your eardrums and gives you a headache, and so you're going to start doing it back to me?
No.
Because it seems like that's going to hurt you as much as it's going to hurt me.
It is. There's no winning that.
I often wonder if, like, the whole... paper thing. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it again. That was just
yes, you did.
Adding insult to injury. No, I was just wondering if that actually does cause physical pain to anybody else, because I've been doing it for like 12 years.
No, I think it's just because I'm here and we have the sound. At least you and I both have the sound cranked
ungodly
up.
Loud.
Ungodly loud.
So. Okay, yeah, so we're going to talk about, if we get a chance with Aramesh, we're going to talk about the recent history, probably just in the States, and things in popular culture that have been blamed, you know, for just inciting nutcases to do nutcasey things. So that is all coming up. I have a bunch of small things, but I can tie them all together with one sort of red bow in terms of what I did last night discussion. Because you were talking earlier about, you know, the whole thing of seeing Burt Bacharach or Paul Anka or somebody in Los Angeles and going like, hey, wait a minute, is that? And then in Portland, you see somebody who looks really familiar and you try to figure out, is it just because it's a small town and I've seen him a lot? Like, does he live in my apartment? Or have I just run into him at the store before? Or is he, in fact, somebody of note? So I had that situation with Outlook Portland this morning. So I before we came here, I was in Beaverton. I was taping an episode of Outlook Portland, a very fine program which airs Sunday mornings on the CW. That's cable channel 3, the Gossip Girl Network. You can also find it online. It's on the YouTube, or you can go to outlookportland.com. You really ought to check out last week's episode with novelist Willie Vlotten, by the way. It's really one of the finest episodes we've ever had, and I'm not just saying that. But I had that happen this morning because you know how last night they were saying that we were going to get all that snow? And there was going to be the ice, and the whole city was going to be paralyzed, and nobody was going to be able to get anywhere.
That happened, right?
Yeah, except that it didn't. Yeah. But I don't really know the whole story behind this. I don't really know. I don't know exactly what led to this chain of events. But we were taping Outlook Portland this morning. But last night at around, I don't know, like 11:30 or so, I'd have to go check Twitter to be sure. But around 11:15 or 11:30 last night, I got a text message from Cheryl Kanakoa saying, because we were going to be having Anna Griffin on Outlook Portland from the Oregonian to talk about sort of notable things to expect in the coming year politically in Portland. You know, sort of big stories that were on the horizon that were probably going to come across our transom. You know, big news items that were waiting to be resolved. So apparently it's not the weather. I guess it's stomach flu. So that was scheduled this morning. We were going to be talking to Anna Griffin from the Oregonian for Outlook Portland. So like 11:15, 11:20 last night, Cheryl sends me a text message. She's like, by the way, no Anna Griffin tomorrow. She's got, and I guess it was the stomach flu. She sends her regrets, but she can't make it. And here's the thing about Outlook Portland is that we have to have a new one of those every week. They don't do any reruns. So you got to have 52 shows a year. And we try, it's a point of pride with us that we try to stay several shows ahead. But, you know, you get out of the holidays and it's like we were 3 weeks ahead, but we sort of burned all those off. So it's like we had to have one for this Sunday, and it has, and because it has to be filmed, edited, put together, and then sent to Seattle, it can't be done like Friday. Like, it has to be done by Wednesday morning. So around 11:30 last night, Anna Griffin is just like, I'm not gonna be able to make it in. I'm sorry, I can't do it. Like, please forgive me. And you know, just so I get this text from Cheryl, and she's like, you know, we may be effed here. We have to try to figure out, you know. And so I'm sitting at home thinking to myself, ah, Christ, you know, because I just, you know, I've been working on all this, you know, show prep and trying to figure out exactly how I'm going to do the interview. I'm not faulting Anna Griffin. You're sick. That's fine. These things happen. But I'm just thinking, oh, God, what are we going to do? By the way, my solution, was that I swear to God, I was just going to sit there and I was just going to like interview myself for half an hour. So the person who said that jokingly on Twitter, you cut me to the quick, sir. So close to the bone do you strike with that. Because that was really going to be my big miss. That was going to be my fantastic breakthrough solution, is I was just going to sit and like literally with a sock puppet just to interview myself. Or, you know, we have that new bit we do on Outlook Portland where it's the editorial reply, where it's like Godzilla or like Paul Stanley as a rubber duck giving. And it was just, I was just going to write 22 minutes of editorial comment from Paul Stanley as a rubber duck or from Megatron or somebody. And that was really how I decided to solve the problem. Meanwhile, Cheryl, of course, proving that she's the more responsible one, immediately takes to Twitter and she lays out the situation. She's like, hey, so we had a cancellation. We got to, you know, we were looking for a last minute guest for Outlook Portland. We got to have somebody who, you know, if you have something you're talking about, something you're promoting, maybe an event coming up, this is, you know, this doesn't happen very often. A chance for you to get on television and really to talk about it and to have, you know, a full half hour to discuss whatever it is. And anyway, so long story short, we ended up talking to this guy this morning, Harold Phillips, who is he's a local actor. He also works a lot to keep things like tax incentives for film and production companies from other states, to keep those incentives in place so that TV and movies keep getting done here. So he really is an activist for trying to get out-of-state productions to come to Oregon. Fascinating guy. Really, really interesting guy. The show went really, really, really well. But it was the thing of looking at his picture and trying to figure out if I knew him or not. And it turns out that he's done a lot of, like, commercials and a lot of sort of smaller parts on television. And it's the thing of sitting across from a table interviewing some guy who just seems really familiar in a way that you can't quantify. Even once I figured out that it was, like, bit parts in movies and that he had, I guess, he'd done a small bit on Leverage and that he, again, had done, like, a car lot commercials or something. And it just sort of weirds you out. that it's somebody who exists on some small, you know, lower strata of your brain. So that was this morning. All that is less important, though, than this. So I had all of the prep done for the interview with Anna Griffin this morning. And that was at midnight last night when she said, okay, new plan, you're interviewing this guy. And I'm like, but I got all this Paul Stanley is a rubber duck thing I'm writing. And Cheryl is just like, she's no, 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 that's stupid. Listen to me. Here's what you're doing tomorrow. You are talking to this guy, Harold Phillips. That was at midnight. So how many hours of sleep would you imagine that I had last night between midnight when, and again, I'm not faulting anybody for this, these things happen, the show must go on, between midnight when I found out that I had to rewrite all of the content for Outlook Portland this morning and, let's say, I don't know, now.
Two.
No. No, that's much too high.
45 minutes.
No.
None at all.
No, it's none.
None.
None at all.
None at all.
So I have been awake now by my calculations. I have been awake for 31 hours. Wait, 24 plus 7. Yes. So I've been awake for 31 hours right now. And I have to say, really, the fact that I am speaking with some, like, a modicum of rationality and that there's some sort of sensical conglomeration of words coming out of my mouth and that I can, you know, tie my shoes. I mean, let's hear it for me. Let's hear for strength under adversity.
I have now been working with you in some capacity or another for close to a year between our meetings and then us actually starting to do the show. And I now had the opportunity to see you on 2 hours or less of sleep on occasion. And I will say this, you are usually very cheerful, almost more energetic than when you sleep. And you get this sort of maniacal gleam in your eye. I can almost tell now when you have not slept because you come in and it's like the coyote trickster has taken over Rick Emerson, and I can actually see it in your eyes.
Is it the look like baby's gone off for meds?
A little bit, yeah.
So there you go. So that would be, I guess that would be me today. So duly warned, everyone. I feel like I should do like a wah-ha-ha-ha just for sort of effect, but I would be contriving it. So
it's anything can happen day.
That's
on
right.
The Rick Emerson Show.
So that is, anyway, so that's where I am mentally today. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email rick@rickemerson.com, dawn@rickemerson.com. And Aaron Mesh will join us here in just a few. Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch, Jackson Watch, Top 5, maybe greatest songs ever made, probably not. I do want to do, but again, a quick shout out here to Cheryl for really in the space of like 9 minutes, figuring out the problem, identifying the problem, and then coming up with a solution to the problem, and also like steering me away from my retarded idea, which would have just been me, 38 years of age, sitting at a desk at like a $1 billion corporation using television and like half an hour of unbelievably expensive airtime playing with a Godzilla doll and then like a thing, like a Vince Walking Dead figurine and going, you know, what do you think, zombie? I don't know, Godzilla. You know, and then giggling to myself, apparently. So, thank you. And also to Harold Phillips, who was a great guest and who we're going to have on this show at some point. He was quite something.
I have heard of Harold Phillips, and I've heard good things about him. That he basically is responsible for us having a film and television industry in this state.
I had, you know, it's one of those things where, and apparently he's been a listener for a long time, too, and I felt sort of bad that I was not more I'll put it this way. He's the reason that there was a Leverage episode for me to be on, because it's, you know, he is the guy who has really campaigned. I mean, he's not the only one, but he's really been one of the loud guiding voices in trying to get, you know, more film and television production to come here. And he's one of those guys, too. I don't belabor the point, but he has such an internalized understanding of how that industry operates. Because I was like, well, you know, because he asked me, he said, well, how do you suppose that we get film crews and productions to come here? And I said, well, we just give them money. And I guess that's true, like in tax breaks or whatever. And in a very vague, broad, not really accurate kind of way, I guess that's how it works. But I had no idea the minutiae involved and the machinations involved in getting those industries to come here and to stay here, for like Leverage to come back for like a season 4, and for a Brain Trust, which is that, you know, the new Devlin Rogers joint to be here. And I guess it's, did you know that, I don't know if I should say this. I think he said this on camera. Oh, this is where the sleep deprivation really has a possible downside / upside. I don't think I'll get in trouble for saying this because I think it's a known. I think this is known. That they rewrote the Brain Trust, which is the new show coming up from John Rogers and Dean Devlin, who do Leverage. They actually rewrote the show to take place here because they dig Portland so much.
I've heard that already before, so I don't think that's a huge secret.
It was. I mean, but how cool is that? I mean, and it's like, and that is, you know, and that's good because it's a great town. But the reason they even knew that to begin with is because they came here because of guys like Harold Phillips who made sure that those companies and those industries were in town. So that's going to be this Sunday, and we'll have him on here. He's a fascinating guy, really. So, all right. What did you do last night, Dawn? I bet you slept.
Eventually, yes. Well, I've been going through like some crazy brain stuff and was feeling bad. And as I mentioned yesterday, I guess it was yesterday, the day before, I had mentioned that I spent much of the weekend just sort of being crazy. And so I felt bad for my husband because he, you know, Patrick has to put up with that.
Because he might have realized he married a crazy woman.
Well, at this point, I think he realizes that. We've been together 11 years.
I think
he knows.
Somebody knew it was a sled from the very beginning, Don.
Yeah. So, but still, I still feel bad when this happens. Like I said, this happens every few months, and I feel bad. And like, so last night, it was kind of like, I'm sort of in phase two of the crazy brain, where now it's like, I sat down and I had like a notepad, and I had to like, I realized that I have like way too many projects that I'm in partial things going on. So I sat down and I was like listing all the things I need to work on and trying to prioritize them. And that, of course, is not a good thing to do when you're in that kind of hypomania kind of crazy brain thing.
What is hypomania?
Well, hypomania is that part when I don't know for a fact that I'm bipolar. I was told by a doctor once that I had bipolar tendencies. And the thing is that a lot of people, if you have these tendencies, there's depression, which is the I'm sad and I can't do anything and I don't want to live and I just want to go to bed and eat Oreos. And then this is sort of the flip side of that, where you're like, I have a lot of energy and I'm going to do things and I'm going to like make, and I am not making this up, by the way, I'm going to find scrap fabric and cut it out and I'm going to make stuffed animals by hand and I'm going to sew buttons all over them because I think that'll be awesome.
Tonight.
And I'm going to stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning making a button bear.
I've never done anything like that.
Right. So I'm kind of sliding into that part of it right now. And so last night it was kind of like I was explaining to Patrick, I was sorry about having been crazy. And, of course, not acknowledging that I'm still crazy, just a different kind of crazy now.
But the thing is, part of the crazy, you know, there's a certain stripe of the crazy which is not just productive and useful, because you can get things done, it seems like, you know, because, I mean, you know, you can channel even a tenth of that into, like, emptying the dishwasher, you know, then he's home free. But also part of it is just less unpleasant to be around.
Yeah. It is kind of fun to be around, but it's also, this is where people who have, like, really serious problems with, like, bipolar disorder and stuff get get into trouble, because this is where, like, people who have, like, shopping problems and stuff, yeah, I'm going to get into my car and I'm going to drive to Las Vegas. I'm going to go to the mall and right. I'm just going to buy 27 pairs of pants. You know, I mean, you can actually, yeah, and with me, it tends to be like, I have an idea for the most awesome project ever and I'm going to start it right now and I'm not going to go to sleep until it's done. And so, but yeah, so last night it was a little like, I'm sorry that I'm crazy right now and I'm stressed and I'm worried about some things. And then we heard from the doctor that there was nothing horrible going on in his liver that they know of. So he was cleared of all kinds of terrible life-threatening things. Although, being doctors, they're like, we still don't know why stuff's going on. So we want to send you to OHSU to talk to this kidney transplantation specialist who knows everything there is about kidneys.
So that's just a big ball of uncertain...
Liver.
Let me ask you this. Now, do you have the... it's funny to say the hypomania thing, because I don't think I've... I'd never really heard that term until, to no one's surprise, Storm Large... was talking to me at one point. And this is when she was ramping up. She hadn't quite unveiled Crazy Enough yet, but she was getting ready to do her one woman show, her musical, the stage play, and where she talked about being put in the ha ha hole for a while. And in diagnoses. Mm. One of the things that she was diagnosed as having was hypomania, and I didn't know what that was, and I sort of like. And it's like I wanted to be cool too, and so I didn't ask, because I was like, oh yeah, hypomania. No, that's the pits. Yeah, that sucks. And I didn't want to ask ask her to clarify it. But so I'm glad that you have. Now, is it the sort of thing though? If it's being really relentlessly like amped up and often very like just disproportionately motivated, is it the sort of thing that can be triggered by or exacerbated by or possibly reversed by a sudden infusion of good news?
Quite possibly. I mean, I don't...
Do you have known triggers for it?
For me, my triggers for everything tend to be stress. That when I'm stressed, then usually the depression comes. Depression and anxiety for me come from being stressed out. Often the last year or two has been about money and money stresses. And I understand apparently this is very common because, unsurprisingly, people who are bipolar tend to be kind of bad with money.
Yeah.
And people with tendencies towards such. So, because like I said, I don't know for a fact that I am. But then the stress over money tends to make you feel even more fatalistic and worried. I don't know. For me, the hypomania stuff, I'm not sure I literally don't know what causes it. And I've tried to figure out over the years. It's almost like I can feel almost a chemical change in my head. I can feel a physical change in the way my head feels. And it's like, and yeah, and I have more energy and I talk faster and I've just got all of these ideas just rolling through my head, And then, yeah, I come up with these amazing creative ideas, often which are really, really excellent. I'm very creative and very productive during those periods, but also...
But then, like, 3 days later, you're just asleep on the couch for 4 days and just stuffing yourself all the tater tots.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, when it gets really bad and somebody comes over to my house and I'm sitting there with a needle and thread and sewing buttons all over a handmade bear.
It's like the Tasmanian
devil.
And
they go, wow, did you make that? And I'm like, yes, I made it. I cut it out and I did it. I needed a pattern because I didn't have a pattern, so I traced my stuffed animal and I did this, but I don't have a sewing machine, so I had to make the whole thing by hand. Yes. And they're just going... Are you okay?
Somebody, Dawn is in squiggle vision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit like that right now. And then last night, besides trying to plot out all of my projects and figure out what I'm doing next and what order I have to do them in, I also made Patrick dinner. So I decided to make pasta carbonara. Because we'd had pasta carbonara at book club on Friday, and it was delicious. And really, it's nothing but really just pasta and bacon.
You know, because what you need at that point is more energy. You really need
more carbs.
Yeah, just amp up your metabolism a little more. Just give yourself more fuel. So we're really a prize pair today.
We are.
We're like a charm bracelet of crazy. And we only need the two charms because, you know, we're like a Heisenberg particle, just sort of everywhere and nowhere all at once. All right. Well, in any case, so it's going to be a great show. You can already sense it's the best show ever just on the horizon. Today.
See, when we actually get the vending machine and we actually put eels in it, that's when we know we have to be worried.
Yeah. See, that's the sort of thing where there's no external. Well, I guess there's Cheryl, by the time she got here, You know, by the time she got here with the gun, you know, to solve, to do what needed to be done, I think that, you know, we could have done a fair amount of damage. But hopefully, you know, we'll have tells before that happens, you know.
We need really less a... less an intern than we need a handler.
I was just going to say somebody who has a, like a trank gun that they could just sort of, you know, or just like a remote tasing, or they can just, or like something in that, like in Walking Dead, where she can just clean the facility remotely where there's fire that just shoots out of the walls.
Or at the very least, somebody who just has a very calm voice and can say things like, you guys, I don't think that's a very good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, well, you know, that was like the you know, never mind. We're just getting off into a hole. Like, it's like 10 after. Poor Aaron Mesh is sitting in the kitchen, probably.
Probably.
Sitting there just grooming his mustache like a walrus. You know, or possibly something else.
It's lying on his back, cracking clams on his belly.
I'm covered in barnacles. Oh, it's going to be a great day. It's 503-505-6964. We'll talk more about, hey, we should do this, because Sarah and I used to do this to people, and I think we did this to you. Sarah and I did this to you, sort of a hazing, one of the first times you came in the show. When Aaron comes to the show today, and you have to help me, like, press him on it if we know he's lying, we should interrogate him at length about his craziness, if it exists.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe it doesn't,
because,
do you
still have that test for the, like, OCD
stuff? Oh, the Copeland
test.
Not with me, but I do own it. I still have the Copeland test for yet to determine if you're OCD or ADD. Yeah.
One of the things I did last night when I was, like, in the middle of my, like, really being manic, I got online and I thought, maybe I am bipolar. How would I know? And I looked at one of those things of signs of bipolar disorder, and I had, like, every single one of them except for one. And then I'm thinking, but is that one of those things where when you're just reading something on the internet, you just map it onto yourself? Or am I really that?
No. Here's the thing. I've taken some of the... Well, first of all, I've taken the clinical ones. I don't know if I ever actually showed you the results of mine.
You brought that one into the studio once when I was just a guest.
Yeah.
And you and Sarah and I all took a nut... We didn't do the whole thing because there were, like, 200 questions or something.
We didn't have the patience.
We got distracted.
Too long.
Easily.
Look, a thing.
But yeah, we did a thing, and yeah, we all three turned out to be fairly crazy.
Yeah, and that was like an actual, like... Like clinical one that I did where I was like trying to actually sort of, you know, give reasonably correct answers, you know, as I understood them in some sort of objective way. But I've taken the things online too where sometimes you just score really high because you sense that the things are just so broad that, like, you know, that everybody would fall into that, you know?
I feel sad sometimes.
Well, yeah, it becomes like a Scientology, you know, test where the guy with the paint cans outside, you know, at the mall is, like, having you hold them by the skating rink and go, would you rather receive orders or give them? Ooh, let's see. Okay, you have thetans clogging your ears or whatever. Or whatever the hell. But you know, sometimes when you're taking those tests, though, you can just tell, and you don't say anything about it out loud, but there's just the ring of truth inside your head. Where like, tab A fits into slot B perfectly, and you go, oh, no. And then you just, and if you're me, you just close the browser window, and you don't take those tests anymore, because they're frightening.
Not to get off on too much of another subject with Aaron Mesh sitting on thinking, but I did want to ask you, this is something new for me. Do you find yourself coming up with new ways that you realize you're crazy, like that you weren't crazy before, and they're like new things? Because as an example, I'll do this. And I think I mentioned this on the air before. I've developed this OCD tic about checking to make sure I have my car keys. It started with being like really concerned I would lock my keys in the car, and it turned into a thing where I check like 4 or 5 or 6 times now to make sure. I take the keys out and I put them in my bag. Then before I shut the door, I check to make sure they're in the bag again. And then I push the lock down and then I forget if they were in the bag or I don't trust they were in the bag. So before I close the door, I look one more time and I realize I'm just like way now, over-checking the number of times I check to make sure I have my car
keys. Now, is this replacing or is this a different variation on a thing? In other words, did you do that before with something else?
I don't think so.
Like checking the iron or something?
No.
All right. Because so it is. Because in other words, it's like you're not swapping out one. It's not like Mad Libs. You're just changing one noun for another.
No, I think this is like a whole brand new behavior.
We should have a shrink come on the show. Did I ever tell you that we had this? Okay, then we have to break. We don't even have time to do news now.
No.
We have to come back with the Aaron Mesh, you know, who's probably just sitting there listening to the show and just wondering, you know, and just texting.
Can I leave now?
Yeah, Siri's just having like a moment of examination where he asks himself why he comes here every week. I have no idea what I was going to say. And, you know, that thing is, that is the hand of, that's the universe intervening right there for the good, really. Because I have no idea what I was going to say, and it's probably just as well. We should take a break. improbably enough. We'll come back. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be here. We'll poke and prod his delicate human brain and see how nuts he might be. Corpse Watch coming up. Snuff Watch. Jackson Watch on the way. Top five songs about drinking and so forth. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It's Wednesday. Stay there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's Wednesday, January 12th, 2011. It's 503-505-6964. If you'd like to be part of today's program, 503-505-6964. Just moments, we'll be joined by Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Also, Corpse Watch coming up today, Snuff Watch, Jackson Watch, and the top five songs about the drinking. So that's going to be coming up later on, probably in this hour, because of the 92nd anniversary happening this week of Prohibition. So that is coming from the mind of Don Taylor. Speaking of the mind of Don Taylor, well, screw it. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program from Willamette Week, screen editor and stylish man about town, Aaron Mesh. Hello, sir.
Hello, Richard.
How are you on this fine Wednesday, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
It seems
debatable just looking at you.
I was going to say there's such a multiplicity of ways to answer that question, all of them leading back into some weird funhouse version of their own reflection. So I'm just going to skip ahead and talk about the fact that I think we mentioned this when you walked into the studio today, that for different reasons, Don and I are both feeling a little bit. Not even a bad mood, so much as it is just
squirrely.
Squirrely, I was going to say, as Linda Perry might say, just a little peculiar. Mm. But squirrely is probably the better way to put it. Almost as though, like, imagine that you were here in the studio with us today, Aaron Mesh, and that.
You're going to kill me in a minute, aren't you?
Well, I was just going to say, here's the thing about today. Today, it's one of those days where I would say that the odds are about. Maybe not, you know, they're not huge, but I would say maybe 32% that at some point during the today's program, one of us, and by that I mean Don or myself, one of us is just going to become, we're just going to start giggling uncontrollably, and then we will never stop. And then you'll be telling stories about us in the future, like, well, what happened to Dottie, old Aunt Don? Well, it's a funny thing. And then we'll slow dissolve to the cell where she will be sitting inside, sort of drawing things with crayons clutched in her toes and still maniacally laughing.
Hey, give us a chance to find out if that thing is true, that if somebody just can't stop laughing and you slap them across the face, it will knock them out of it. You ever see that in movies?
That's not a thing people say.
People crying hysterically, and then somebody, usually a woman, and then somebody slaps them across the face, and it shocks them into stopping crying. And apparently, I've heard that the same thing is true, you know, if people have the giggles.
If you want to just punch Aaron, I'll alibi for you. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care.
A lot of people want to punch Aaron.
I'm going to say, yeah, it's, you know, really, I mean, it's that's a thing you could probably get for less than you might imagine.
See, I was hoping I would get to be the slappy, but then, you know.
Are you talking
that's
about
my own,
sort of,
that's my own personal kink.
Where the sort of Leslie Nielsen.
You roll that way.
Where the sort of straight-laced wooden Leslie Nielsen type character says, "My God, woman, get a hold of yourself!" Wham!
Exactly.
And then they give her the whole, yeah, because she's gone. Yeah.
I think this still fits in the category of like when people believe that women had spells.
Yeah, or they, you know, or they had to like go boil a lot of water or something.
Mm-hmm.
They should boil water. It's good for them.
We should probably get to at least a couple of stories here so we can get some of this done. Then we will come back. We'll talk about Willamette Week. We'll talk about Portlandia, and then we're going to get to the bottom of your own particular brand of crazy. So never you worry your pretty little head about that. At Aaron Mesh. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, since Aaron is here, even though we do not have an actual iPhone watch musical sounder yet, which we need one, I do have our daily iPhone story.
All right, should we just call this a Geek Watch?
We could if you want
think,
to.
You know,
sure,
until,
call it a Geek Watch.
Really, until we have the Apple Watch theme, you know, put together, we ought to just it sort of falls because I would say that it is sort of a the Apple Watch is like a genus within the family.
And this is geeky in multiple ways. So yes, let's make it a Geek Watch.
Here is your Geek Watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
This high speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember you used to...
just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but because we were wondering if the quantum flux. Now just listen on
there. There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn ship. You got it?
Energize.
Here's Don Taylor with your Geek Watch.
South Korean director Park Chan-wook, who is best known internationally for Old Boy and Thirst, has premiered a film that is said to be shot solely on the iPhone.
Okay, I saw the headline about this on Drudge yesterday, but I didn't actually click it. And I meant to go back and look at it later, and I did not. So this is So it's a feature-length film.
It is. It's called Night Fishing. It's said to have the same picture resolution as conventional movies, but it took 80 people, $133,000 and 10 days to make on the iPhone. He said he first approached the project, which is, it's not a full-length, it's a 30-minute film, right, about a surreal encounter between a fisherman and a female shaman for fun. At the premiere on Monday, he said, "New technology always offers wonders and useful features. Testing them is part of the amusement." He also said it was a new experience compared with making a meticulously planned movie. Even a casual and spontaneous shot delivered a surprise. It felt like there were more choices. The scenes were shot simultaneously with two iPhones from different angles, but staffers also contributed with recordings on their own iPhones. And, they said the iPhone movie would be the first ever to be shown in cinemas.
Here's the thing is this is just, like, far less interesting than they would like people to believe it is, though, because the whole Dogma 95, you know, movement where they were trying, you know, everything had to be, you know, natural light and naturally occurring sound, and you couldn't do any sort of pre-production beforehand. And so a lot of times there would be multiple people in a room filming something, which necessitated the use of very small sort of like camcorders. But, you know, even on The Shield, actually, if you go back and watch The Shield occasionally, it doesn't happen very often, but occasionally the way that Sean Ryan would shoot a shot is that he would set it up so there were multiple crew members in the room shooting, you know, doing like a cross cut where they were basically pointing the cameras at each other. They would just sort of be dressed as extras. So when they were not – when their shot, where they figured it was not going to be used or it was just for like a wide master or something, they would blend in with the background. But as a result, they again had to use these cameras that were very, very small and wouldn't be seen. So, I mean, I'm all for a guy getting publicity, you know, however he wants to. But it's not like small cameras didn't exist before. That's just a manufactured piece of buzz is what that
Plus,
is.
It's sort of hard to get excited about a movie looking worse.
Well, yeah, I mean, and plus it's not like, I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, I like that guy's movies, but it's not like he needs any help to make his stuff weird,
right?
You know?
I'm a huge fan of his, and I will say, and that's really, to me, that's the big thing that makes this an interesting story, is that this isn't just some guy making an iPhone movie. This is a really, really good and very interesting director. So
I can't believe I'm taking this side, but I mean, who cares? I mean, it's like it's a camera that's shaped somewhat differently than other cameras you may have used. They're square. This is a rectangle. I'm not trying to hate. Again, I'm all for a guy getting publicity for his movie because that's, you know, that is a difficult thing to do, and marketing and promotion and trying to get media attention. Those are all worthwhile pursuits. But I mean, it's just a phone. It's a camera that's thinner than you're used to.
I know. I
if I had an opinion on this, I'd be chiming in to argue with you, but I just don't care.
It's like I'm so – but that's the thing is I sound aggressively nonplussed about it.
You do. And whereas I'm just like, anybody want to do a hit?
Well, I mean like,
– And you look like that today,
yeah,
too.
I know. It helps.
Everyone measures the towel-y of the Rick Emerson
radio
program.
You look like a character from a Daniel Klaus comic.
Oh, thank you.
I was saying that you had kind of a Lester Bangs thing going on. Like you'd just been up all night just doing it like robo and, you know, and cheap meth or something.
I've been feeling like Lester Bangs lately. It's been kind of a mood.
Well, we should end this Geek Watch here and before it just devolves into open gunplay. And then we will proceed on the other side. Ooh, look over there.
By Grabthar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Ooh, loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
This is the only reason I say this, by the way, is this reminds me a little bit of, God, I guess it's been over 10 years ago now, when Spike Lee put out Bamboozled. And one of the big sort of the gimmicks that they were using to try to get publicity for that film is that it was shot on stuff that was just off the shelf from Shopko.
That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, it was like – and it was camcorders like the size of a coffee cup. I mean, you could sort of tell. I mean, you know, it wasn't like it looked like a billion-dollar movie, but it also didn't look like a home movie. I mean, it looked like a real film. It looked like something you would see in a theater, maybe of slightly degraded quality in some shots.
Trash Humpers this year was shot on VHS. You didn't see Trash Humpers, did you?
Here's the thing. I was trying to figure out if this was like a new line of porn that you were going to be churning out like from your own home.
No, it's a new Harmony Korine film.
Dawn?
Harmony Korine.
I know, but Trash Humpers?
I did not see it, but then I don't like Harmony Korine movies. And since I didn't have to
I was about to ask what Trash Humpers was about, but then I realized I don't really want to know.
It's about old men who hump trash.
And we're done. We are here with Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Let's do one more here of a non-watch nature, and then we'll talk Willamette Week. We'll talk about Portlandia and so forth.
A 72-year-old Miami man. That would be Miami, Florida.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Miami, Florida?
Yes. has been arrested after he allegedly licked a 4-year-old, even though the child's mom was nearby. Roberto Garcia has been charged with 3 counts of lewd and lascivious molestation for the alleged incident, which occurred at a Miami coffee shop on Monday. The police said the child's mother works at the restaurant where Garcia gets his coffee. He asked the woman for a cup of Cuban coffee, and while she was preparing it, he took the opportunity to reach over the counter and fondle the boy's private area. Garcia also tried to make the boy grab his penis, and he licked the boy's ear before the mother could turn around.
Maybe they were out of biscotti.
When she did turn around, he pretended he was just playing with the boy, but the mom realized that there was something up. His kid was probably saying something like, "The man licked me," you know, which is a dead giveaway.
But in Spanish?
Maybe. But she looked at the shop's surveillance video.
I wanted you to do it in Spanish. God,
I don't know what lick is in Spanish.
Well, I'm just looking at his photo again and realize.
I'm not necessarily saying they were speaking Spanish. I was just hoping that you would.
Have you seen the picture of the guy?
No.
All right, so I got to come over here and check this out. I've got it right here. This is his mugshot. Does he not look like? See, that's what I'm saying. I was saying that he looks sort of strangely Russian to me, and it's just a reload for some reason. It'll come back. He looks like one of those guys who'd be sort of like maybe in like the Brighton Beach area, and he would be sitting, and I didn't hear the first time around when we talked about this last time that it was a coffee shop. Doesn't he seem like the guy? He would be drinking coffee out of a tiny cup held over a saucer with like a pinky extended.
I thought Pete Postlewaite was dead.
He has that kind of, I was saying earlier that he had, I envisioned
him. Well, you said the Russian thing. He actually looks a lot like my Romanian landlords I had when I lived in California. The landlord and he and his wife he was always wearing a suit, but it was always the same suit and it was in horrible, horrible condition. It was always frayed and he always just stank of stale sweat.
In Russia, the boy licks you.
And does he have the, does he have the sort of look to you like a guy who might just, he might just have a hook, you know, on one of his hands?
I could see that.
And you don't really want to know why. Like, you figure if you ask him that's going to be a thing where he just fixes you with he sort of glowers at you and then just, you know, and then you eventually have to slink off.
You know, he doesn't look playful enough to want to lick a boy. That's the thing that bothers me, is he just looks angry. He looks like he would punch a boy. He doesn't look like he would lick a boy.
I think you really had it right the first time when you said that he was probably just trying to, it was a sampling, you know? Like, the licking wasn't that wasn't the totality of the act. The licking was really just to try to figure out what sort of seasoning might be required later on.
Well, I mean, also, remember, this is a mugshot taken after the incident, so he is now regretful.
He's despondent.
Yeah, about the boy licking not going as planned.
That's true. You know, I had such plans for us. Oh, the dreams I had, they have been dashed.
He tasted so delicious, and I cannot have any more.
Okay. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday. It's 503-505-6964. If we get bogged down in Russian boy licking. I've been there, sister. That's a whole show in and of itself.
I don't even think he's Russian is the thing.
No, his name's Garcia.
No. That's the name he gives people. That's not unlike the many blonde, blue-eyed guys you meet in Argentina who tell you their name is Hector, you know? But they have a strange collection of ultra-shiny boots they wear everywhere.
So you think he's a Nazi boy licker?
Yes, I do. Still to come, we had your corpse watch on the way, snuff watch, and try to get to that Michael Jackson watch as well. Aaron Mesh is here from Willamette Week. Before we talk about the new issue, before we talk about the Portlandia, so Don and I have something we want to ask you. So the question is, do you, Aaron Mesh, and we may have already queried you about this, but I don't believe we have. Do you have any ritualistic, in an extreme sense, or obsessive compulsive traits?
Oh, yeah.
What are they?
I've got so many, but
share some, please.
You want to hear the best one?
Well, what do you mean by best?
The one that I think can top yours.
It's a bold statement, but go ahead.
Yeah. So when I fly on planes, I have to tap the doorway entrance to the plane on the top of the door with my left hand.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I got to try to visualize this here. Okay, so.
So visualize this. You're standing in line waiting to board the plane. You're in the little walkway.
Yeah,
area,
the little like thing that
jets. And there's this guy in front of you, and that guy is me, who has to take whatever carry-on bags he's holding, shift them to his right hand, stop while standing in the doorway of the plane, and tap the top of the doorway with his left hand.
Okay, so
he's hitting the plane.
When you say hit the top of the doorway with your left hand, when you say the doorway, are you talking about the inside of the frame?
Yeah.
Okay. So and are you talking about your fingers, the palm, the back of your hand, knuckles?
Palm.
So like a sort of a like this kind of a thing, like that.
No.
And if you don't get the chance, do you have to like backtrack and do it?
That was going to be my next question, is what if you couldn't do it? Like, what if you were swept along by the tide of humanity and you were unable to complete the act?
It would be a really unhappy flight.
Would you sit there and you'd be sort of like, would you feel unnerved or uneasy?
I know where the plane was going to crash.
Because you are the thing that is holding it up, of course.
Absolutely.
Because your ritual. It's like, I believe in Grey Lady Down. You're talking about it's like the Betty Grable poster that they all have to slap that's on the door as they go through the little portal or whatever.
Yeah, or like the rock that the Clemson Tigers all hit before they go on the football field.
Exactly.
Yeah. See, I was thinking people that feel like they have to wear the jersey of the team when they're watching the football game.
That's just silly.
Because, you know, that'll make the team lose if you guy are not wearing that one shirt.
All right, so that's one that you have, you know, that I would say that that's pretty interesting. It also happens, I would say, fairly infrequently, unless you're just flying all the time. Do you have one that is a, if not daily, that is a more frequently recurring ritual?
I don't know if I do. I mean, I actually sort of try to avoid them intentionally.
Have you had them in the past, or have they just sort of, or have you gotten rid of them, or is that the only one that's ever emerged?
I'm sure I do, but I think they're almost subconscious.
I have a few questions here I could ask you specifically.
Before we get to that, though, I want to know, like, when did you start doing that? When did you first become aware? Like, did somebody point it out to you, or did you catch yourself doing, like, well, what?
Oh, no, I started doing it on purpose.
When?
Probably about 10 years ago when I started realizing that planes shouldn't stay in the sky.
And so you were unnerved by the idea that you did not understand the mechanics by which planes stayed aloft.
Right. I didn't understand science.
And it externalized itself in... So was it?
But I mean, this may be why I'm like crazy in a different way than like actual OCD, because I created the ritual intentionally. I figured out like, oh, I need something to calm me down about the fact that I'm sure this plane is going to fall out of the sky. What should I do? I think I should tap the plane for good luck.
See, now I think that is less crazy though,
yeah,
because you are
crazy.
You've suddenly become you're yeah. no longer interested.
Yeah, because you know why you're doing it.
Yeah, it's
absolutely almost everything I do is intentional.
And so you have created an external repository,
which is kind of crazy in its own special way.
That's its own way of crazy, right?
I mean, but I'm saying that like that is, you
being
know,
being this analytical about every creepy thing you do. That's creepy.
But that's like, you know, people who are really nervous. It's like the thing about you'll see guys who have PTSD and they'll do the thing of like snapping the rubber band. And some people think that it's supposed to be like an aversion therapy thing, that like you're supposed to snap the rubber band and it's the pain that is, you know, that trains you not to have those memories. And that's not it at all. It's that you are taking all of the – one of the reasons you do is you're taking all the negative energy you have or all the anxiety, and you are externalizing it into something else that is smaller and controllable and more manageable. So that's kind of what you've done here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I have OCD. I have levels of anxiety that terrify shrinks.
Now, I would say that it's probably not, because, again, it's a thing you decided to do that you weren't compelled to do. I mean, I'm not saying it's not crazy.
It's just not an OCD thing.
I don't think I have OCD. I have, like – tremendously high levels of anxiety.
Do you do that with anything else? Is there anything else that unnerves you?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, do you have
a lot of rituals that you've created for yourself to try and manage anxiety?
Yes.
So like what? So like what's an equivalent to that that is not, you know, that's something you would encounter more often?
Going to bed every night. Like I have extremely careful rituals about like making the bed before going to sleep, because I have a hard time sleeping.
Now,
to prevent insomnia, I have rules about like brushing my teeth and folding the bed sheets before getting into bed. Not because I actually feel compelled to do any of them, but because they give me something to focus on.
I don't know. I feel like I need to be an – this is weird. I feel like we're entering some strange area where an actual shrink would have to come in and make this. This is like an IBM You Make
it's
the
tricky,
Call
isn't it?
Sort of
yeah.
a thing.
See, I have a whole lot of things I do before I go to bed that have become ritualistic, because I suffer from a whole lot of anxiety and I have trouble getting to sleep. And so it's like these things that I have found over the years that help me sleeping have become vital to me being able to sleep.
Right. It's like same for me.
I will take a hot bath and read before I go to bed, because the hot bath helps relax me. And I found now I can't go to bed unless I'm clean. If I go to bed and I haven't bathed, even just taking a shower, I feel itchy and uncomfortable, and I'm aware of the fact I'm not clean. I have to have like a full glass of cold water. It has to be cold water. It can't be room temperature mm-hmm. water, and it has to be next to the bed so that when I need water, there is water there. And I have and it drives my husband crazy, because it takes me like he'll just go get into bed, and it takes me 10 or 15 minutes to actually get ready for bed, because I have to do all of these things.
I'm similar. I'm like a dog that like circles the bed like five times before he can go to sleep, that kind of thing.
So I'm wondering, so it seems like these are, so the distinction here.
I feel like a shaman sometimes, like I'm doing some kind of like ritual, like smoke signal thing before bedtime. Like, and now the other tribesmen will know that I am going to sleep.
Waiting for Johnny Cash to appear and take you off to the spirit world.
Now the spirit of sleep will come to me.
See, because come now.
So these are falling into two different camps. So there are the things that make sense, but that you just have worn a groove in your head with them. And so the example, the way that Tony Robbins always describes this is that something starts as a thread, then it becomes a string, then it becomes a rope, then it becomes a cable. And it's like the more and more you do something, a ritual, you know, a habit becomes a ritual, yeah. Becomes a requirement. Some of them are things that make sense, but they just became exceedingly important to you. Then there are things that make no logical sense and become exceedingly important to you. And that's like tapping the door inside the airplane. Mm-hmm. And then it's like as a sub-discussion there is that you created it intentionally. So what the hell does that mean? And then there are things that are exceedingly important to you and make no sense and didn't come from anywhere in particular or from any place of logic. There's also exaggerations of things that would theoretically make sense if you were not compelled to do them like seven times. So this is like your thing of checking your car keys. Because mm-hmm. I used to have, and here's the other thing. Do you ever do this? Because you asked me if I'd ever developed like new rituals. Like if I began, my God, I've created some, like if I have to turn the light switch off an odd number of times, which is a thing. And see, here's the thing, and I had never thought about it until this moment. You know, the thing that I have developed is because Lara always goes to bed before I do. And so this isn't a ritual, but this is just sort of like a thing we do overnight where she goes to bed and, I will stay up and get some work done or whatever. But she always asks me to check the alarm clock on the way out of the room just to make sure she doesn't want to oversleep or whatever. So we have just the old school kind with the switch in the back. And if I go and I check the alarm clock to make sure that the switch is in the, on position so that she doesn't oversleep, it's not enough to just look and actually see that the alarm is set to the on position. It's not even enough for me to like put my hand on it and press it up to make sure that it can't go up anymore. You know, I can't actually just physically verify that it's already up and in the on position. I must turn it off, then turn it back on. But I must do it an odd number of times. So it's got to be like 3 or 5 or 7 or something. And I have no idea when I started doing that. And that's a thing that I've been doing probably every night for like 9 months now that it never occurred to me. But see, as the yang to that yin, a thing that I used to do that I then just mysteriously stopped at one point, and I have no idea when I stopped it or why. I used to have an equivalent to your thing with the car keys, but mine was the parking brake. And so I would park the car sometimes, if not always, like on a perfectly level, flat surface. Like I would be at the mall parking lot. I'd go to the shopping center, park the car, set the parking brake. Take, the keys out of the ignition, check the parking brake again, and I have the kind that pulls up. Get, my bag or my cell phone or whatever, check the parking brake a third time, get out of the car, lean in from the open door, check the parking brake, while I'm standing outside, but leaning in, close the door, lock it, occasionally go back and check it as I'm on my way to the store and have to turn back. And there have been times, not a lot, but there have been times when I would actually be shopping. I would have like a bunch of crap carrying from store to store as I'm completing my whole like swath of purchasing. I would actually have to leave the mall, walk back out to the parking lot to the car, and just to check that the parking brake was still on. And then I could go back inside and resume my shopping. And that's the thing that I did for years, and I haven't done it for probably 10 years. It just stopped at one point. It just left my head. So that's kind of bizarre. And it's sort of unnerving. You see why people get freaked out by this, the idea that there's like some little switch man in the base of your brain, like a Lily Tomlin, operating a phone system somewhere who's just patching in various sections of crazy to other counties inside your cerebellum.
Yeah.
And then just disconnecting them later for reasons that are totally hidden from you.
Yes.
All right, then.
I find it actually sort of calming, oddly enough.
Well, that's the whole point.
Right, I actually find the concept of it kind of calming. Like, I don't find it disconcerting because I think that's the way that you keep from actually going crazy. Like, that's your brain's coping mechanism from keeping you from, like, gibbering in a corner and rocking quietly, is that it finds ways to, like, relieve pressure.
I don't see, and I don't disagree with that. To me, it's just the only unnerving thing about it is like, the idea that you're...
The problem people are the people like Jared Lee Lochner who don't have, like, little OCD habits and instead are insane and shoot people.
Well, maybe he...
One of the things that gets me is, like, I'll look at some of these things. Like, I've got one of these, 27-question obsessive-compulsive disorder tests up. And things that it hadn't actually occurred to me would be something that they would count as that. Like, one of these questions, do you fold newspapers back to the original way after reading them? And my first thought was, well, of course I do.
Doesn't everyone?
Yeah, of course I do.
Yeah.
My grandfather used to do that, like, religiously.
But I mean, that's what you do. You don't just leave them willy-nilly and wrong side out. You put them back.
Well, you and I have talked about
that. The thing is, if you work in the newspaper industry, though, like, after a while, you just get so sick of the damn things, you just start ripping them up.
Well, you and I have talked about the whole thing with, like, you know, you and I think, have different legal pad rituals, where I got a whole thing about the way I have to tear the paper off and the way that it's got to be twisted and the way that I, you know, and if the little, you know, and if...
and we both have that thing that we can't stand the little hanging leftover bits.
But we deal with it in different ways. I actually just tear the whole top off, and I will go down to where the paper is just an inch high because I've torn strip after strip trying to get it right. So my thing with the newspaper, here's the thing that I used to do much more of this when I was younger. We were talking about you and your hypomania state of being awake for a long time. And, you know, and I've been awake for like 30 whatever hours. But that's just because I had no choice. I
mean, that was circumstantial. That wasn't crazy.
That's what I'm saying. That's like a different thing. Because a thing that I did when I was, I don't know, when I say younger, when I was like in my, I don't know, my early to mid-20s is, and again, that just stopped for no readily apparent reason, is that I would occasionally just like stay up for like 4 or 5 days. And then I would sleep, you know, for 2 or 3 days, like in a row. I mean, I would stay in bed basically, you know, for you know, 48 or 72 hours. But occasionally, I don't know, probably, I mean, not a lot, maybe like 2 or 3 times a year, I would just have some jag where I just wouldn't be, I would in fact be just vibrating with energy, and I would stay awake for, you know, I'd stay awake for, you know, 96 hours or something just 'cause. And it's like I sort of knew that it was unusual.
That may not be healthy.
Well, but see, like at the time,
yeah, doctors like, would say
you're sort of aware that not everybody does it, but it didn't feel like I was. It didn't feel like I was in danger of, you know, of like falling apart or keeling over or something. I mean, I knew that I felt like sort of, you know, that I was sort of bubbling over with energy or whatever. Like I was aware that I felt hyped up, but it didn't. But it wasn't like I felt as though there was something wrong with me as such. It was just like somebody had jacked you full of a lot of caffeine or something. And then again, that just like stopped when I, you know, when I hit 25 or 26. That just, you know, that doesn't really happen that much anymore. Good God Almighty! All right. Well, and I was telling them we always do these things on Wednesday when you got to take off early for a ham-fisted radio. So maybe that's your ritual: is that you introduce some fascinating topic of discussion on a day that we cannot possibly finish it.
Maybe my brain is just more interesting on Wednesday.
You have some sort of fetish with giving conversational blue balls or something. Maybe that's your deal.
Is that it?
That should be the name of your show over at Cascadia, from Hamvista Radio to Conversational Blue Balls.
Conversational Blue Balls.
With Dawn Taylor. At the news desk, it is the aforementioned Ms. Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
We have a Michael Jackson watch.
Awesome. So for the first time in a long time, ladies and gentlemen, this is your Jackson watch for Wednesday, right here in the Rick Emerson Radio program. Single entendre. You never let me down. Here is Dawn Taylor with your Jackson Watch.
On Tuesday, at a preliminary hearing to determine whether Dr. Conrad Murray will be tried for involuntary manslaughter in connection with the death of Michael Jackson, a coroner's official testified that the pop icon was basically healthy, but that, as his personal physician, Murray provided him with, quote, substandard care.
Could there be any bigger lie than to say that Michael Jackson was, quote, basically healthy? I mean, that goes beyond what the legal system would call a transparent falsehood. That's just ludicrous.
Dr. Christopher Rogers, a forensic pathologist, told the court that Murray was wrongly using the powerful anesthetic propofol to treat the singer's chronic insomnia and that he should have more closely monitored Jackson while he was under sedation. Rogers said he didn't believe the defense's suggestion that Jackson may have injected himself with propofol, though he told the court that it's possible Jackson may have swallowed some of the drug based on the amount found in his stomach after his death. On Monday, a detective who questioned Murray in the wake of Jackson's death said the doctor told him he noticed Jackson wasn't breathing shortly after 11 a.m. on the morning of his death. According to phone records, Murray didn't call paramedics until 12:21 p.m., a delay that prosecutors contend demonstrates negligence on Murray's part.
You know, that guy, and we've talked about this before, how he seems almost comically guilty, like of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what he did or what he didn't do or what they may convict him of or what he may plead out on, but it's like he just seems like guilty, like to a level that almost reaches buffoonery.
Well, let's see. We have a man who is suffering from insomnia. And as we've talked about, I think all three of us have suffered from problems sleeping here and there.
Never.
You have a doctor who is basically knocking you unconscious, like putting him close to a medically induced coma with an anesthesia. medication.
Can I say that as an insomniac, that just sounds awesome.
It sounds wonderful.
But it also sounds a little bit medically sketchy.
Just did that thing again. Yeah, but you know, but here's the thing. Can we all – okay, now look, now we're back to it. Can I just say this? Can we all agree that if we had the money and wherewithal, we would totally be having that done?
Oh, yeah.
We would totally get a doctor. Now, the thing is –
I would completely have a quack doctor who would just write me prescriptions for all kinds of things that are bad for me.
Here's the thing. That's not what you do, though. You get a couple of quack doctors because they need to work in shifts. Because there needs to be a guy by your bed all the time, and his sole job is just to watch, like, the tachycardia meter or whatever, the thing that just goes like beep, 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 and he's flatlining, you know, and then they put a stick between your teeth and they tase you or whatever. They just wait, you know. That's the problem, is that they only had the one guy.
What was that Kevin Bacon movie about people who killed themselves?
Flatliners. It's a good day to die.
Oh, God.
It's a terrible movie.
It is really a terrible
movie. I'll take a great concept, bad execution for $1,000.
If I was like Richard Branson, Bill Gates, wealthy though, I would have like one of those doctors where I could just have him come. He'd probably live on the premises, and he could just come in. I call him on the phone, and he'd walk in from the next room, and I could just say, "IV Xanax, how would that work?" And then we could discuss.
Here's a fun one, like just to keep this conversation going, because why would we ever want to get to the things that are actually on our schedule? But is it interesting to you, like, maybe it's interesting to me only because I have insomnia, but that the two, I think, arguably largest celebrity deaths of this new century are both insomnia related.
What's the other one?
Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
Oh, is that true? I thought he had, like, the flu or something.
Yeah, but I mean, he was taking so many sleep meds. I mean, the level of Ambien in that boy's system was
I don't think I ever
nuts.
Saw the list of what he took. Yeah, I didn't know what it was. Was it Ambien?
Three different sleep meds simultaneously.
I've never taken Ambien. It sounds awesome, though.
It wears out is the problem.
Well, it wears out. Since when has that ever stopped anybody from taking a drug? You know, this is temporary.
Yeah, but I'm telling you from experience, it wears out.
But what does that mean?
That means that it stops being interesting.
Well, okay, like, it implies that it is interesting at some point.
Oh, it works. It works great for like 6 months.
Did you have the whole thing of, did you do things that you did not remember doing later?
Or did you just build up a tolerance to it or something?
There's a woman in my monthly book club.
You could give me an Ambien right now, and I just keep sailing right through this conversation.
So it scales really quickly, the amount that you need. Yeah.
There's a woman in my monthly book club, and she takes Ambien, and it's like her husband and her kids have to basically keep an eye on her. She just goes in. We actually got to watch a video that they made of her on Ambien. But it's that thing. And this is why I don't think I'll ever take it, no matter how bad my insomnia might get, because that terrifies me. She's one of those people that, and a lot of people have this, she will walk around the house and have crazy conversations and decide she has to clean her closet and do all this, and has absolutely no memory of doing it the next day. None whatsoever. She's just, and that terrifies me.
Yeah, see, that's the thing.
That never happened to me. On the other hand, I live in a small apartment, so it's quite plausible that, like,
you have to set tripwires for yourself ahead of time.
Who rearranged my furniture?
That's one of those things where it's like the Ambien. The idea of just taking a thing that just turns my brain off is just awesome. I mean, the appeal to that just cannot be overstated. But I'm with you in that I wouldn't do that for the same reason I want to take acid. In that, like, there's a bunch of stuff lurking, like, in the bottom toy boxes of my brain, and I'd prefer that it just stay there. And, you know, even when you're conventionally asleep, you have some control over that because you go from asleep to awake pretty quickly, you know, for most people. And so even if, like, you're doing something weird, like, we've all done the thing where you're like your significant other comes to wake you up, you know, how are you? And you go, robot tuna fish. And they go, what? And you go, nothing. I was just saying that isn't the sun beautiful this morning? And you get control of yourself pretty quickly. I don't like the idea that the control has been removed from me for like 8 hours. So that's a thing that I would probably not take. So
again, I mean, from experience, I mean, this is entirely subjective, but I did not find that it had that response for me.
But I mean, but did you find that until you built the tolerance up, did it give you like peaceful sleep?
For a while, yeah.
Because some of that stuff, it just knocks you out and you wake up and you just feel, you know, drugged but in the bad way. You just feel groggy and terrible.
Yeah, I didn't find it to be as I mean, I still take very low dosages of it. So, I mean, I don't know maybe I just didn't experience the full Ambien effect. Like, but...
Well, why don't you try that and get back to us?
Yeah, I'll be right back. Give me 8 hours.
You know, when you talked about having a doctor where you're just like, you're wanting to know, you know, where if you can just, you know, if you can just have Xanax, like, run directly into your ears or whatever. The answer to that is that, of course, you can, because I mean, we've all had. I mean, I've had, you know, that, like, I've talked about, you know, having the whole hair thing done, where it's like the guy Like, they just gave me, like, a huge – it wasn't even a bottle. It was like an envelope of drugs. I mean, they just gave me, like, a paper sleeve full of Vicodin and another one full of Valium, way more than I would need, by the way. And he actually just said, so you want to go back to your room and just, you know – and he – I swear to Christ. And he's like – you know, he's like an actual – like an actual doctor. I saw the degrees on the wall, and they didn't look like they were dot matrix printed or anything. And he said, you want to just take a few of these together? And I was like, well, okay, done and done. And I mean, and it was just, you know, and I'm sure, and I'm not saying there was anything untoward happening there. He's, I'm sure he was licensed, and I'm sure that he was, you know, that he was doing everything within the confines of the law. But the law itself is just very elastic and porous. I mean, it was really easy to get those. And I think I mentioned to you, you were talking about something, you're like, was it you tried to get like Xanax and they wouldn't give it to you?
You know who's really good for that, though? Dentists.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I had my wisdom tooth out last year and you know, it was hurting a bit. So they gave me an ass ton of Vicodin. And then I came back and was like, I'm not sure how well this is working. And they're like, you want some Oxy? And I'm looking at them kind of, like, alarmed.
Really?
That's the stuff they keep on the time control in the Walgreens because people will kill you for that stuff.
Right.
Like, I don't think I want the Oxy. I'm not even sure I want the Vicodin, to be honest. Like, how about just a lot of Advil?
Who does? Who says I'm not even sure I want the Vicodin? What kind of person are you?
I took the Vicodin. I have a lot left in my. Oh God! Now I'm going to get robbed. I have a lot left in my uncle's house.
I need you to keep Aaron busy for just a little while. Well, that's Derek Humphreys, who was the guy at the Hemlock Society. They wrote that book, Final Exit, about how to before assisted suicide laws, about how to end your own life if you were terminally ill and whatever. And one of the things they talked about was how incredibly easy it was to get the doctor to amp up what he was giving you. Not even just the dosage, but to, like, change the drugs until eventually, I guess, what you wanted at that point anyway, at that time, which I guess would have been the late 80s, the drug of choice if you were going to take your own life was Seconal. And so his whole thing was, he's like, you don't ask for it all at once. He's like, you ask for a sleeping pill. You say you can't sleep. They'll give you something that is pointless. You come back in, like, 2 weeks. You say this isn't working, you know, and you just, like, you know, rinse, wash, repeat, and you do it like 5 or 6 times. He's like, you don't even have to take any of the stuff they're giving you for the first couple months. He's like, all you want to do is come back, be very rational, lucid, you know, defer to his judgment and say, I mean, we don't have to increase. I mean, I don't want to, you know, run the risk of, you know, drugs are dangerous. I don't, but if you think it's, you know, and he's like, the doctors, you know, within a couple of visits will be like, well, we'll just try some Seconal, see how that works. Because I think that it is, you know, it is because it does work. And I think that's why they eventually, that was the huge appeal to me of Vicodin. And I swear to God, we have to quit talking about drugs as soon as I make this observation, because you've got a bunch of stuff to talk about, Aaron Mesh. We have the top five. You got to get to.
I might just leave and go do some drugs, to be honest with you. This is amazing.
Leave. You're sitting next to Dawn. She's probably in her purse, just got nothing at all.
Nothing at all.
Any kind.
No.
That's what I meant to say.
All right. I have a flask of Pendleton whiskey and a bottle of Vicodin.
Is
but
that
other
true?
Than that, yes.
Okay. You should do sort of a quiz. That's what we should make people do to win the prize.
What does Dawn have in her bag today?
What illicit substance is Dawn carrying in her bag?
They're not illicit. I have a prescription for the – well, I guess you're not
you have
supposed
to – a prescription for the flask?
You're not supposed to carry around a flask.
The Green Hornet whiskey. Tonight?
No.
Because we could prep for that with some Vicodin and whiskey.
Where is that?
Oh, it's down in Bridgeport.
That's right by my house.
Anywho, the thing about Vicodin that did really appeal to me is not even like the high as such. It was just – it was that there was like no effing around with the pain relief, you know? It was like I got a little bit of an ache. Vicodin, gone.
Bang, yeah.
It was like an off switch.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as much as I make fun of, you know, we talk about House and some of the things that are written badly on that show and some of the unbelievable things, that is a thing that I never doubted at all. Because the one time that I had a muscle injury and they gave me, and it wasn't even Vicodin, it was Loratab, which is like, you know, from years ago. And it was like, I took that and you're used to waiting for the Tylenol to sort of kick in and to sort of dampen the pain down a little bit. And this was just like a scorched earth approach. It was like you took it and it was just and the pain was obliterated.
I feel so much better now.
I mean, it was like, and it's like, I can't even imagine if you had like a real serious, especially a chronic pain of some kind, how unbelievably tempting it would be to just take that all the time. Because again, it's just a binary, you know, state for your pain. So, all right.
Yeah, the problem with Vicodin though, for me, like, is the come down sucks. Like the coming off of it.
When it wears off and you're just not even the pain, but just the sort of mental state of being off of it.
Yeah, the mental state of being like the high is awesome for about 45 minutes, maybe an hour, and then like there's another 45 minutes or an hour of coming off it, which even on one Vicodin for me is just like a hellish 45.
God damn it. You get to be like Brett Favre, who was like, this is why you don't want to do drugs, kids. He was so hooked on Vicodin that he described, you know, he's like, And not that anybody in this room would know what this is like, but he talked about how, you know, if you're taking a drug, it's like he's like, even the drug itself, he's like, that's, you know, that's great. But he's like, you get a rush even like opening the lid and be like anticipating that you're taking the pill. He said he was so hooked on Vicodin. This is so horrible. This is the sort of thing they should tell you in class, that he would take the Vicodin and then he'd throw them up again and wash them off. Just so he could swallow them again, because
he found
the ritual, he found the idea of like, and I'm swallowing 8 Vicodin, so great that he wanted to do that over and over again. So he had this weird anorexic thing going on with his, and bulimic thing going on with his Vicodin intake, which is like, that's the thing that like drugs make you vomit and then swallow things again. That's why you shouldn't take them.
Like a kid out there.
We're surprised about the whole penis picture thing after that, are we?
I guess that's what, you know, one of the reasons. And I, you know, I've talked about how I'm just relentlessly lame in terms of, you know, substance intake and whatnot. But I had somebody tell me one time that he said that ecstasy was actually the only drug that he had to use another drug to come down from. He said that otherwise the crash, like the post ecstasy wear off, was so horrible that he actually had to use kids.
See, I never found that myself.
The Rick Emerson Show, we're not even within shouting distance of what a role model looks like. But he said that he actually had to use a little bit of coke to come down off of ecstasy, because otherwise the crater was so bad that he would just take he would take ecstasy and it would wear off and he wouldn't have any drugs in his system. But like the come down was so bad, he would stay home for 3 days after it worn off. Yeah. And he was like, so he had to start taking coke to like take the edge off the ecstasy crater. And he said at that point, that is like, when he was like preparing for his evening's entertainment and he had like a postage scale and like a bag of pills and like a scoop, and I think he had a little moment of like looking at himself like Gazoo and went, I've chosen poorly.
Who was it? Was it Johnny Rotten who used to drink an entire bottle of whiskey as a way to clean out his system?
Well, it seems like that would work.
Sounds about right.
That's the Sarah Dillon thing of like, I'm going to burn this fever out. Aaron Mesh is here from Willamette Week. Willamette Week, his employer, who they do not advocate, condone, endorse, promote, or encourage any of these behaviors.
But nor do they drug test.
That's awesome.
Come work at Willamette Week, except that there's no money.
That was, the timing on that was so sublime. That was a thing of just the most rarefied beauty, Aaron Mesh. God bless you. If I wasn't all man, I'd give you a big kiss right now.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right. Let's hold on. We're just going to take like 10 seconds here. We're just going to reset a little bit in our – hold on. Let's just – we'll take a little –
They're going to start.
Let's talk about the new issue of Willamette Week, Aaron Mesh.
Hi.
Shall we?
How you doing? I don't even know how to segue into whatever.
Segue into your job for that.
So there's two things. There's Portlandia and your festival that you run, and then I don't know if that is related to what is in the new issue of Willamette. So you can proceed.
It is, yeah.
Proceed as you like, sir.
So let's talk about the preview show of Portlandia, which is our head out feature this week in Willamette Week. So this Friday night at the Hollywood Theater, it's unfortunately sold out. There are two screenings of the first two episodes of this Carrie Brownstein, Fred Armisen television show.
And have you seen
Portlandia?
Them?
I have seen them.
Do you feel like you can give a sort of a generalized review?
I don't feel like it would be a good idea to talk about it. All right. It's not out for another week and a half.
Okay, so but it is
a debut.
And it's on IFC. That's when it's going to be.
Now you can see some sketches that they did previously on the IFC website, and then that marvelous little sketch
Dream
with
the
90s, song, the
yes.
Dream of the 90s.
I will say that I think the show has some very brilliant moments. I can't go further than that.
I'll say this. I was actually – I haven't seen anything. And in fact, that thing, that Dream of the 90s thing has been sent to me by like 7 skillion people, and I have yet to watch it. I have this special folder for like links and YouTube videos and just like stuff that I got – you know, people say, hey, check out this 4-minute video. It's you know, it's a couple minutes, but it's really good. And I'll just watch all that stuff like in one glut on a Sunday or something. So I haven't actually even seen that. It's been sent to me, but I haven't watched it.
Oh, it's delightful.
But already I have to tell you this. I won't say where, but I will say that actually within the last couple of days – and it wasn't here and it wasn't in Outlook Portland. But the last couple of days I have actually – is that thing has already started to happen though, where I have overheard more than one conversation from people who – you suspect have really seen almost nothing of it, and they're already arguing about whether it is, you know, complimentary or insulting, and whether it's going to have like whether it's going to give the city a bad name or whether it's going to be, you know, good because it shows the rest of the country that we're interesting. Like people are already starting to like divide themselves up about it. It hasn't even gone on, you know, TV yet. So
yeah, people love their tempests and teapots.
Yeah.
But at any rate, if you want to see the show and you don't have cable, this Friday's out. However,
you're screwed.
You are lost.
Tough luck, old son. But
that's hard cheese.
However, on the 21st, this is sponsored by Beer and Movie Fest, which is the festival that I run, which is getting started with this. This is our kickoff. This is how we're beginning the season. We're going to run all the way through April. We've got programming at the Laurelhurst, the Academy, other venues, which I can't talk about yet. I can't even tell you about most of the programming yet, although a lot of it's solidified because we debut our website, bamfestpdx.com. We debut that February 1st.
And is that one F? Beer and Music Fest. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, BAM Fest PDX. But that, so that will be online by
that time.
That will
be online by February.
Okay.
And that's where we'll debut our full lineup for the season. But at any rate, so we're starting up our season with Portlandia and the big preview slash party, which apparently like half the Decemberists are playing, I don't really understand, is taking place on Friday. But the following Friday, the 21st of January, which is the day that the show actually premieres, we're showing it at the Mission Theater, McMenamin's Mission.
And this is going to be the first episode or the first two?
Just
or
the first episode.
The first episode.
We'll be showing all six episodes live for free
at
the Mission every Friday night at 9 p.m.
So what is – I'm sorry, go ahead.
So there'll be live musical acts. This week the Morals are playing, and in following weeks there are other bands that are playing.
They'll
play live sets before the show, and then we will show the entire episode live on a large screen.
And so that begins on the 21st. You can find out more at bamfestpdx.com
live. This you can find out more about simply by going to Willamette Week.
That's confusing.
Willamette Week.
Okay. All right.
Bamfest PDX will not go live until the 1st of February, unfortunately.
Let's just back up for a second and let's talk about Carrie Brownstein herself. So obviously she's in Slater-Kinney, but what is the road from there to writing, to doing this comedy show?
So she met Fred Armisen back in, I think, 2003. Fred Armisen's always been in some ways involved in, like, the indie rock community. Like, he's friends with Jeff Tweedy. You know, that whole scene is, you know, mildly incestuous.
Right.
And he had requested tickets to a Slater-Kinney show, and they met backstage, and they hit it off. They started exchanging emails, talking about comedy and music. And then he was visiting Portland at one point or another, visiting some friend, and said, why don't we do something together? And she thought he meant, like, let's start a band. And she said, I don't really want to start another band. And he said, let's not start a band. Let's actually make sketch comedy videos. So they started making sketch comedy videos together in 2004 about bicycles and food carts and very distinctively Portland things. And then about a year ago, Armisen was looking for a side project off of Saturday Night Live, where he impersonates Barack Obama and other things. And so he said to Carrie, why don't we take these little sketches that we do for the internet called Thunder Ant, and why don't we make them into a television show? And she said, cool. And then they said, hey, Lorne Michaels, you want to produce this? And Lorne Michaels said, cool.
That's just one of those things where it's like A leads to B to C to D so easily.
And here we are.
You know?
Like,
yeah.
It's not that complicated a story. It's just odd.
Yeah. I mean, and just that it seems to have just come together with – I mean, I'm not saying it was easy, but it just seemed to have naturally just one thing led to it. Like it was this inexorable chain of events that led to it.
Well, Carrie Brownstein's life seems to work that way. I'll be interviewing her about this at the Hollywood on Friday, but we'll be doing a little Q&A after the show.
Well, she took a little side trip and became like an advertising copywriter at Weedon Kennedy for a while, didn't she?
For 6 months, she loathed it, actually.
Yeah.
She says that she told me this for a Willamette Week interview, that when she wants to – she says if she ever commits suicide, you will find the notebook of her Wyden and Kennedy work by her side as an explanation.
Wait, did she
hated it that much.
Well, she had to like come up with like rebranding
Starbucks.
Oh, okay. So she was having to like – you know, she was like – she felt she was having to do hack work.
Well, she felt she was, you know, whoring, I suppose,
right,
is the phrase. And – so she's done that. She was an NPR blogger for about 2 years. She had a blog on NPR, which was entirely a music. She was a music critic for NPR for 2 years. I mean, everything she sets out to do, she does at an extremely high level of capability, which is a little frightening.
Is it – do you – I mean, do you get that sense? Like, does she – because sometimes people like that, you can just tell. Like, they sort of vibrate with energy. And sometimes it is – you know, they're just very unassuming and you don't – they don't, and they don't externalize a lot of that insane creative energy.
As somebody who I recognize as being not entirely dissimilar from myself, which is a good-natured but highly neurotic creative, like somebody who is like secretly really ambitious,
where you can see the crazy just underneath the surface, like it just sort of.
I'm not sure it's crazy necessarily, just like exceptionally ambitious. Like not somebody who enjoys vegging out and watching television for 8 hours straight.
I guess when I say crazy, I'm using it as a catch-all, but like the artistic drive or whatever.
You know what I'm saying, though? Like, that kind of like this person needs to be working.
Right.
I think that's there. I think that's from when I look at her. I like my guess is that's disguised under a good bit of like learning to be affable over the years.
Right. Right.
But she's awfully nice. Like one of the nicer people I've gotten to interview. But that said, like you can tell there's like drive.
And
there.
I guess that's the thing is you talk about there's people who are just on the outside they seem. You know, they seem relatively normal or low key, or you know, they keep themselves sort of well managed. But there's that sort of churning that is just sort of like right underneath.
Yeah, but I mean,
at the age of
20, she was in one of the hottest rock bands in the world.
Right.
I mean, so in a good way, I think. I'm not sure you ever recover from that.
Is it? Is
maybe the word "good" isn't helpful here? Maybe like just in a way that isn't necessarily destructive.
Do you get the sense that any of it comes from like from just proving that it's like she's more than Slater-Kinney?
I don't think that bothers her. Just a gut feeling. I don't think that that's a motivator.
What do you think?
I think a motivator for her is that she can't sit still.
That she just there's too like much there's, going on in her head.
There's a story she told me that didn't get into my Willamette Week profile, and I wish it had. We just didn't have room for it. Where I interviewed her at a bar, and we were sitting and having a glass of wine, and she was trying to explain why she does so much. And she said, "Well, before I came out to meet you, I was feeling edgy, and so I went in my backyard and I jumped rope until I couldn't jump rope anymore. And then I came out to the bar."
Okay.
Because I felt less edgy.
That's one of those.
I think that tells you a lot. Like I think that's a personality style, which again, I think there may be a little bit of that in this room as well.
We were talking the other day about them.
So is she motivated by Slater-Kinney? I think she's motivated by the need to burn off energy that she can't burn off jumping rope.
That's the thing. Is like there's that in some people you just sense that there's this weird like plutonium powered engine that is always revving at like maximum RPMs. Always. And Henry Rollins has always struck me as, and again, on the surface, you know, for being such an aggressive guy, he has such a laconic personality. I mean, he very rarely like raises his voice. And you see him in interviews and he's very like, but in that way that you sense it's like the wheel that is going so fast, it's standing still.
Yeah. I mean, she would do 16 hour a day shoots for Portlandia and then leave the set after 16 hours to go volunteer at the Oregon Humane Society.
Wow.
So
I forget who this.
Which,
who,
by the way, the screenings this week benefit them.
That's the charity.
That's the beneficiary of this Friday's two big premiere screenings is Oregon Humane Society.
I forget who we were talking about last week about whom we originally said this, but we were talking about somebody, and I made the comparison. I think I said, you know, and David Lee Roth, which I say like all the time about everything. But we were talking about somebody who, if they had been raised today, some artist, a musician or something, if they had been raised today, they would have probably all of their genies would have been like riddled out of them, because it's that, you know, again, it's like the hyperkinetic engine that is always sort of spinning around inside, and I think a lot of that gets tamped. I mean, I don't know, because I don't have kids, but I get a sense that a lot of people like that, you know, it's like the kid who just won't sit still and is constantly hyper stimulated, you know, intellectually or otherwise in class or in school or whatever. And they, and it's a thing that it is a thing that society is just not set up to deal with. Mm-hmm. It's not even out of malice or out of evil. It's just that like anything, it's like McDonald's is set up to serve, you know, the vast wide swath of the American omnivorous public, and Walmart is set up to handle people of a certain body type, and schools are set up to handle people of a certain attitudinal bent. And anybody who doesn't, it's like they're really just trying to do their best to so everybody can get through the next 9 years.
Well, I think we also have a hard time as a society, and I'm not necessarily speaking about Carrie here, but figuring out what to do with people whose RPMs are moving higher than everybody else.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, take for example like Mark Zuckerberg. Like somebody who has been portrayed almost entirely as like Mr. Villain.
Right.
Like has no social skills, is basically autistic. Like what's wrong with this guy? Well, maybe what's wrong with this guy is he's just moving faster than you.
Right. Right.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, and it's like that's where you get those like Philo Farnsworth guys who are like, you know, he's like building a television, mm-hmm. you know, from like his blocks when he's 3 years old or whatever. And
I was playing this trivia game last night, and there was a question about Nikola Tesla, and you answer the question, and then it's like, and the thing was like, I guess some organizing body just finally decided to give him credit for inventing the radio.
The earth.
Inventing the radio,
yeah.
Which has always been attributed to Marconi, who didn't. But then there's always a little follow-up bit of trivia after you answer the question. And this one was like, it just said, on his deathbed, Tesla was designing a death ray that would bring down airplanes out of the sky.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and wasn't he also like working on something that would split the earth in two?
Probably.
Really, like, I've seen pictures of this thing. It's terrifying. He was working on like this internal explosive device that could cause, like, if you put it in the middle of the earth, like it would cause the earth to just split in half. Because that's useful. We definitely need that.
That's the thing. How do you even? It seems like you can't even really test that. You know?
No, there's no test run on it.
That's it's a one shot sort of a device.
Will it work? We'll find out.
Jesus.
There'll be a very short lived after party.
God damn.
Woo!
Don Taylor, let me ask you this. This is completely on a different subject altogether.
Okay.
Are you wearing more or a different style of makeup today than you normally do? Are you wearing eyeliner today or more eyeliner or in a different way?
I might be more eyeliner than I normally do. It might be darker or thicker on my eyelids than normal.
Is there any particular reason for that?
No. It just...
Would you tell me if there was?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't usually have big eyeliner secrets.
Okay. I'm just saying it's not like you examined your reflection in the mirror this morning and then thought about what you were going to be doing and who you were going to be seeing for the rest of the day and adjusted your makeup accordingly.
Are you hinting that I like put on more makeup because Aaron was going to be here?
I didn't say that. Well, and
like I was dolling myself up.
No.
I was getting all gussied up for the man.
All kidding aside, I really wasn't thinking of anybody in particular. But that is a thing. If you see women who wear, you know, it's not like you look the same every day, but women have a certain way they put on makeup. And I noticed that it seemed like your makeup was a little more pronounced. And I thought, I wonder if there's someone she'll be encountering later in whatever fashion for whom she was putting on extra makeup.
No, I
put on more facial hair for you.
Like, I thought so.
It's having the desired effect over here, let me tell you. All right. Let me just take a moment to – there's really no way to – I don't know. I should make a whole Tesla thing. Oh, my God. Have you seen the video – and I know that I'm like the last guy on Earth probably to have seen this. Have you seen the video of the kids playing Iron Man while they're standing inside a giant Tesla coil that is arcing down and hitting their guitars?
No, I have not.
No.
Oh, my freaking God. It's these two guys, and it's like – I think they have a backing track for the percussion. But it's like one is on a bass and one is on like a lead guitar, and maybe there's a rhythm guitarist. And they're standing inside this huge, like, Tesla coil, like, array that is set up, like, in a warehouse somewhere. And then the guy gives the, like, the 1, 2, 3 count, and then they start doing the, you know, like, the droning, like, and then they just start playing Iron Man. And they're playing these guitars that have inordinate amounts of metal on them. And at various points while playing, one of them will, like, he'll hit a power chord and, like, hold the guitar up, and then the Tesla coil arcs into it. And there's these huge, like, jillion volt arcs of electricity that come down and hit the guitar. And I don't know enough about electricity to know why they're not dead. But it's amazing. And I just sat, and it's like, here's the great thing about it. It has no purpose. None. There is no practical application except for me to go, that is effing sweet. And then just, like, send it to everybody I know and go, get high and watch this. You know, it's, like, the best thing I have ever seen. If you go online, you just put in, like, like Iron Man Tesla coil. Like, how many results could there possibly? The only results would be people going, oh, my God, have you seen this thing? Look at it. So it's really amazing. And of course, they're like 20, maybe. And that's those, you know, it's like those kids where it's like.
Oh, those kids.
Well, I talked about being at the.
Those kids and their Tesla coils.
I talked about being at the Museum of Atomic Testing in Vegas where they, you know, it's the history of the history of nuclear technology and the atom bomb and, you know, and so forth, and Marie Curie and all of that. And they will just have, you know, sketches and schematics drawn by, you know, some, you know, like what's it, the, it's not Heisenberg. Who was the guy that helped America create was it Wernher von Braun? The guy who helped with our missile program early on?
Yes.
He was like, here's something he did when he was 7. And again, it's like some Tesla thing where it's like a rocket that can fling you to Pluto. You know, and he was just sort of sketching that while he was in school. And you realize, like, I could study my entire life and I will never be 1/1,000,000th as smart as this guy.
I was just, I'm listening on audiobook to the Bill Bryson At Home book. And one of the things he was talking about was the history of rectors and vicars in being like insane, like mathematicians and writing dictionaries of the Icelandic language and things because, like I said, they had a lot of time on their hands. And
rector,
so one guy.
Damn near killed her.
this fellow.
Really?
Hay, I believe his last name. Hay or May, who wrote some theorem, which is. is very, very popular today among the mathematicians. But at the time he wrote it, in like the 1800s, there was no real good use for it. He just scribbled it down. In fact, he didn't really think that it was particularly useful, and someone published it like after his death. But it has something to do with backtracking and sort of back engineering mathematical things to make, to get results of things you want, and is incredibly useful and used all over the place in computers. But at the time he wrote it in the 1800s, he was like, oh, and I came up with this theorem, but I don't know what you'd use it for.
Well, and that, and that's like that whole, see, now it's just like we've just entered some weird J.J. Abrams world of the Rimbaldi device, you know? And Arvin Sloan is just, you know, going, and he could not have possibly known what Skylab was, and yet he drew pictures of it with this lamp or whatever. Well, that's like, that's, what's her name? I forget, it's Augustina or Augusta, something or other, but she's a woman who lived in the early 19th century, like in 1806 or whatever, and she's generally considered to be the author of the very first computer program. Now, there were no computers. There was nothing on which you could run it, but she created a series of commands which could be put into, like, you know, a device constructed of wooden dowels or whatever, and turned by Clydesdales. And it was, but it was a way to create a non-thinking, non-human, inorganic device that could be given instructions and it would produce then a sum or a desired outcome, and it would calculate and tally things for you. And she wrote it without any actual machines, even in, you know, even theorized at that point, that would have run it. And you just think, like, what? That is where you really just have to thank your stars that almost everybody, if, you know, at most, they use their power for, like, mild annoyance, you know? Like, there's just guys at MIT that are just, you know, they're just turning the entire lawn blue over at Harvard or something, that they're not actually trying to blow the earth in half because of the almost certain success that they would find doing that.
And all of that is in Willamette Week this week.
And brought to you by SquiresElectric.com as well. You can find more about Squires Electric at SquiresElectric.com, or you can call them at 503-252-16. Don't ask them to build you like a death ray or something.
If you need help with your Tesla coil.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is they probably could. We should totally have them build a Tesla coil for the studio. Or just one of those big Jacob's ladder things that just go zzzzt. Maybe,
they,
you know,
they could probably just do that from spare parts they've got downstairs
for the 4th of July or something. You know, just a sort of a little bit of a, you know, just a like a light show, just have running in the kitchen, not unlike a Christmas tree.
You know, for kids.
503-252-1609. That is how you can contact Squires Electric, who inexplicably paid for this. SquiresElectric.com is the website. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. And if you are expanding your business, you're expanding your home, you're going to be remodeling, adding a section on, or you're going to be expanding the broadband needs, or you're moving into a building, it was built 50 or 60 years ago, and you don't know that it's going to actually handle all of your economic needs, your electric needs, they can track that for you at 503-252-1609. Or SquiresElectric.com. SquiresElectric.com. Are we prepared with the top five?
Yes. Do we have time for the top five?
Well, that's a question for you, sister.
Okay.
I don't have to be anywhere.
All right. We'll do this. Well, if I have to skate before it's done, I'll just hand it over to Aaron.
We'll just make sure that we're done in time.
Okay.
Without further ado, here is your top five for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson Radio
five,
program.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count.
I was just thinking about how we're going to get to this top five. You got to go over to do Ham-Fisted Radio, and I was looking at the board and thinking, well, we got to the Jackson Watch. Tomorrow we will have to get the Corpse Watch and the Snuff Watch.
Right.
And then I've got this in some of the greatest songs ever made. So it is really, it's interesting that my OCD has never once extended to just getting things done on the goddamn radio program, ever.
That is interesting.
I have never created a ritual to, you know, like, just say I'm going to do some stuff on the show and then just, you know, friggin' do it.
In fact, you took me to task early on in the thing where you told me that I was worrying about it too much because I was so anxious about, like, but we have to do this and we have to do this. And I was just all wound up.
Well, we wrote down that thing to have Aaron do today. And we never got to that.
Yeah.
I hate me.
And we talked about it at the beginning of the show that we better remember to do it.
I just pray for the embrace of death.
It wasn't juggling, was it?
No. Do you juggle?
No.
Well,
that's why I was worried about it.
Okay.
The kids call it juggling.
So our top five.
Here's your top five. These are your top five songs about drinking. This is because of the 92nd anniversary, the passage of the Volstead Act, or Prohibition. That was this week in 19. So that would have been, what, 1919? Is that what we figured
Indeed,
out?
Indeed, 1919.
Don Taylor, what is the honorable mention?
My honorable mention is Robert Mitchum, Little Old Wine Drinker Me.
I don't think I know this song.
Robert Mitchum, who actually recorded an album, he recorded the theme for the movie Thunder Road.
I'm praying for rain in California so the grapes can grow and they can make more wine. And I'm sitting in a honky in Chicago.
I'm so puzzled as to how to feel about this.
And a woman on my mind.
This is a specialized choice you made here.
Thank
I'm at the man behind the bar, bar the jukebox.
This song has been covered by a couple of people, like Merle Haggard did a cover of this song.
It's good.
Back
yeah.
to Tennessee, when they ask who's the fool in the corner.
Big hook now.
I say, little old wine drinker me.
All right, no, good choice. I don't say I was opposed or skeptical. I was uncertain about how this would work out, but I approve.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Robert Mitchum. And so what is it? It's an album? He did a whole album?
Yeah, I think there was just the one album, but there might have been more. But yeah,
bad either.
The theme from Thunder Road was actually a big hit.
And it's not like a Golden Throats thing where he sucks, or something where it's like Mae West. No, this is actually, I mean, it's not bad.
And especially interesting because we all know that Robert Mitchum actually did enjoy
his tipple,
the drinking and the weed,
yes,
because he was arrested for marijuana possession.
And I think whores too,
quite possibly,
and just punching guys in the face.
But you know the thing about Robert Mitchum, he was hot.
Yes,
he was hot in a way that movie stars today are just not hot.
Not my type, but hot. Yes.
Yeah.
I'd be afraid that he would injure me if we were to have relations. Doesn't it seem like he'd probably injure almost anyone?
Well, he's got that Henry Rollins kind of masculinity where it's like, you know, sense of humor, really smart, but just like so physical that it's actually almost a little scary.
Like having sex with a fleshy refrigerator.
Yeah, that could crush you.
Yes.
Like, well, I guess a refrigerator could if it moved. And if
top five
penis.
Songs about drinking. Don Taylor, number five.
Number five, The Pogues, Streams of Whiskey.
Can I just tell you a connection I wish I'd never made? It is impossible for me to hear anything but the Pogues without just seeing that one horrible picture of Shane McGowan's teeth.
Oh, I know.
Which I only saw once, and then I closed the window and never looked at it again, and that was like 10 years ago, and it doesn't matter.
You could never forget that.
That's his avatar in my head, always.
That's why I enjoy the Kiss My Rural Irish Ass shows in Portland, because it's like seeing the Pogues with teeth.
There should be a band called the Pogues with teeth. Like a cover band or something.
The Pogues, and then parenthetically,
well, with teeth.
Kiss My Rural Irish Ass, KMIRA, it actually is a Pogues cover band.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay, so yeah, I didn't know.
They're mostly members of the Decemberists, and they only play twice a year.
Oh, see, I thought it was a festival of some kind.
No.
All right. I guess they have a name for that. It's the St. Patrick's Day. Never mind. I'm telling you, though, the Pogues with teeth, if I saw those two bands on a bill and I didn't know anything about them, I think I'd go for the Pogues with teeth. Because, you know, it's funny and it's parenthetical.
Right.
I was going to ask for, like, what is the song about? But I think...
It's about going where there's streams of whiskey flowing.
Yeah, I think really... I think the equation here is not that difficult to figure out.
There is not a subtext.
No.
there isn't. There's no symbolism at all.
No, it's not what you'd call a subtle song.
These are the top five songs about drinking. Don Taylor, number four.
Number four is The New Pornographers, The Slow Descent into Alcoholism.
Sort of jaunty for being a slow descent.
Yeah.
Let me just say this.
This isn't your Bukowski alcoholism. This is your Chris Farley alcoholism.
I'll say this about the New Pornographers. They're a band that I hear referenced all the time, and every time I make a little silent vow to myself, like, I have to listen to more things by them, and then I forget about it. And every time I hear them, I love anything that I've been played by them. But I always forget to sort of follow up on my own.
My slow descent
early one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sad this doesn't get played in bars more often.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it is.
It's got that thing where the hook isn't the hook. The hook is that staccato rhythm in the verses. And I think the first half of the chorus, it sounds like this, but it's not, I think. But it sounds a little bit like a na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na thing, which is totally the way to my heart. Okay, what is this song
called? I had a feeling you'd like this song. It's called The Slow Descent into Alcoholism.
Awesome. I'm totally going to get that. We are cutting down the top five songs about drinking, in the opinion of Don Taylor. That is what number?
That was number four. This is number three, Snoop Dogg, Gin and Juice.
You know what it took me a long time to figure out? The guy at the beginning of the song is whizzing here, isn't he?
Yeah,
I thought it was like he was pouring out something for, probably not for his dead homies, for his homies who were standing in line impatiently waiting for a drink.
Nope, he's peeing.
No, he's whizzing, yeah. You know, I think about this sometimes with notable pieces of music. It's strange to think that there was a time when this record didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day it came out and... You know, and the same thing with the Chronic. You hear the Chronic, and you think like it was odd that one week there was no Chronic in the record stores, and then suddenly it was just available, and and it was a real before and after. What a strange time in music this was. Not a bad time by any means, but it was a strange era in music. Especially when you go and you watch that. There's that the documentary Welcome to Death Row, made by. And I forget the filmmaker's name. It's like a guy with a woman's name. It's like a Leslie something or other. But it's called Welcome to Death Row, and it is a. If you read Have Gun Will Travel, which is I think the Ronan Rowe book about Death Row, and you hear the conditions under which these records were being created, like the fact that a guy would come into the conference room at Death Row and he would say like. You know, RBX tells a story about the guy comes in and he's like, it's like, hey, I'm a rapper. I'd like a record deal. And like Suge Knight would just look over and go, okay, like you can do 16 bars. If we don't like it, we're going to beat your ass. And the guy would be like, okay. And he would get like three and they would just go over and just light his ass up. I mean, they would just like go and just beat him savagely in the conference room. And then they would just kick him out into the street. And it's like that would just be, that was just sort of, that was action item two on the agenda. And then there was like one of those motivational posters where it just shows like, it just shows like a bunch of blood soaked rags. And it says motivation.
I think that's how they hire at Nike, too.
And at 4 o'clock, ass kicking.
By the way, RBX himself later said that he was negotiating a contract point with Suge Knight, and the point was brought into stark relief by Suge grabbing him by the back of the head and shoving his face into a piranha tank. So,
is that why you wanted a piranha tank at the radio station?
No.
Okay.
It's because of the glory of nature, Dawn.
Oh, sorry.
These are the top five songs about drinking. Dawn Taylor, where are we?
Number two, The Ramones, Hair of the Dog.
This is a cover of the Nazareth song?
I don't think so. I wouldn't know if it was. It might be. When I woke up this morning
from the nap before my brain. No, okay, this is not a cover. Because they did that album of covers, and I wondered if we were going to hear the... I don't think I know this song.
No.
What album is this from?
I don't remember.
This sounds like sort of like late 80s, like sort of like Mondo Bizarro era Ramones, but I don't think I know this.
I don't know this song.
Yeah. The Ramones had several songs. They also had that Somebody Put Something in My Drink song based on a real incident where I think Joey Ramone developed a whole series of OCD behaviors over the years because of things like because somebody dosed him backstage. And
that'll do it.
Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We'll have number one here in just a moment. I want to say that today's show brought to you by EH Vending. You can find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com. You can also call them. That is Josh at 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. And if you are a business owner or operator, if you have one store or perhaps at many locations, they have all kinds of things from your traditional, your snack and your soda machines to the coffee services to, the larger selections of machines if you're going to be stocking a small store. So if you're finding that maybe you're not able to find the deal you want with your current vending provider, or if you're starting a business and you find that they want you to have at least 5 or 10 locations before you get a price break.
Or maybe you just want to have, like, a vending machine with live eels. in your office.
That was, by the way, one of the many subjects of discussion that indicated to us that was our moment of clarity early on in the show when we realized that we might be trending toward crazy today. When Don and I were talking about wanting a vending machine so we could sell people cup of noodles but cup of eels, and whether or not it would be cheaper if the eels were alive.
And how much would you pay for a cup of live eels?
Don't answer
out of a
yet.
Vending machine.
No, answer.
$3.75.
Okay. Are you hitting the microphone with something?
Accidentally, yes. Sorry.
Okay. You can contact EH Vending. That's Josh at 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204 or ehvending.com. Don Taylor, what is the number one song about drinking?
Number one is Frank Sinatra, One for My Baby and One More for the Road.
Ah, what a great song.
It's hard to argue with this.
The final track off in the wee small hours, I believe.
It's quarter to three.
Ah, oh, come on.
Yeah.
How great is that? Okay, now I really, more than anything today, and I know that I've been, this has been my lament for several days, more than anything now, I want to pull back the curtain here and have it be snowing outside. Because it's all dark, and then, you know, it sort of has that post-Christmas kind of thing.
Set them up, Joe.
What a great song this is.
Gotta disappoint you, though, but it's about 65 degrees out there, right?
Oh, I know. The way you can tell is that they said it was going to snow. So it's like, it's the Costanza thing of like, you know, you say the opposite, and it, no, it doesn't, yeah.
I want it to be 2:45 in the morning.
This is actually what my friend Brian calls this. He calls this 2 o'clock jazz, mm-hmm. And it's always the jazz that you're having as its last call, or you're at home staring at a window thinking about the one that got away. You know, the you had a good dame one time, but she's gone now. And then you look at a street light, you know, and then you hear like a lonely lonely tenor sax playing somewhere as you're hoisting the glass.
And Frank did that better than anybody.
Well, because you suspected that, I mean, as successful and as popular and as whatever as he was, that he was just, he was like deeply effed as a human. I mean, at least, I think, twice tried to kill himself. I think both times over Ava Gardner. So, I mean, it's got to be an ego boost, I suppose. But, you know, certainly a man with his share of problems.
It was Ava Gardner. I don't think he needs an ego boost.
Yeah.
Can't you make the music?
Wow. Have you seen the Leota Rat Pack film?
Yes.
It's a made for HBO biopic, and it's, you know, like a lot of those HBO films, it's not very deep. It's a little bit of a trifle, but it's enjoyable, and it's got a great cast. It's Don Cheadle as Sammy Davis Jr., Joe Mantegna as Dean Martin, Bobby Slayton as Joey Bishop, and Ray Liotta as Sinatra. And this is what they end with this, and it's just him and his it's just Sinatra in his living room, stretched out in a chair with a tumbler of whiskey, and he's staring at a huge framed picture of Ava Gardner that he's got flanked by candles, and then this is just playing, and then it just ends with the needle going to the runoff groove and the, you know, picking up off the vinyl, and it's just the perfect song to end that record.
I'd like to say,
well done, Don Taylor.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I might try my hand at this tomorrow. Because tomorrow's Thursday, then we got Friday, and we might have Jim Willig then round it out on Friday.
Yeah, we could shoot him an email, ask him to bring one in.
Don Taylor can be heard, by the way, this afternoon, 4 p.m. Pacific time at hamfistedradio.com. You can get that later, but it's live at cascadia.fm. That is today. Aaron Mesh can be read online at wweek.com or in print in Willamette Week. And when this goes live, when is your site going live?
February 1st,
and that site is bamfestpdx.com. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milkpacking district in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. You looked like a Florida cockroach just now. I looked over and you froze and then kind of like waved your antennae at me. He doesn't see me. I'm not here. I need some sleep.
Today has been awesome.
Really. At this point, I'm almost tempted just to see how long I can run it. Just, you know, how long can I stay
awake? That's not a good plan.
And I'll say that, and then it's like you'll go out and I'll be frozen in the snow outside or something. Another reason to be glad it's not actually snowing.
Aaron knows that's a bad idea. He's a medical professional.
I spend a lot of time with them.
The Rick Emerson Radio program comes to you live each and every day from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Keel, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa, and I did that whole rap, by the way, after 33 hours of being awake. We come to you every day courtesy of a generous grant from y'all. It is Wednesday, January 12th, 2011. After a brief musical interlude, an encore of today's Legion of News program, and then an encore of this very fine radio program, we'll see you again tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Be safe, y'all. Bye.